Since Chair Diana Dooley is late to the meeting today, she's given me the opportunity to steal the agenda and run with it, and I have a whole bunch of changes I'd like to make. I've been waiting for this opportunity. Anyway, I'd like to call the meeting to order, and it is now 10 o'clock, 10:01. Do a roll call, see we have a quorum present. Kim Belcher.
I am here.
Dr. Ross.
I also am here.
Susan Kennedy is here, acting chair.
Ready to make some big
having
decisions.
A quorum present.
Call this the General Westmoreland moment.
Yes, I'm in charge here.
Actually, I think it was Al Haig.
It was Alexander Haig. I wasn't going to correct him. Announcing the presence of a quorum is here. We do have so Chair Dooley will be here shortly, and we're going to have Paul Feer here today.
No, Paul will not be here today.
Okay, we do have a quorum, so we are going to have a very long closed session today. We anticipate being in closed session for probably 2.5 hours, maybe longer. Oh, I better get this done. The chair's coming. Okay, what else do I want to get done before she takes the meeting back over? We do plan to reconvene in public session at about 12:30 and ask the operator to periodically announce that time to keep everyone posted. Thank you for your patience on this. We are going to the into closed session pursuant to Government Code 100500J to consider contract and personnel related matters. We're going to adjourn and go into closed session. See, my short stint as chair has come to a close.
Good afternoon. The meeting of the Covered California Board will come to order, and someday, somewhere, we may start a meeting with something other than an apology. There is so much to do in so little time, and we cannot seem to estimate the time appropriately, and for that, I do extend an apology because I do respect your time. We are all committed to the same goals here, and everybody's putting a lot of energy into this, and we continue to strive to be better estimators of time out of respect for you and the things that you have to do as well. That having been said, we took the roll at 10 when we adjourned into a closed session, and Board Member Paul Feer is absent today. The other four of us are here. We have no conflicts. That was disclosed as it is at the beginning of every meeting, and we are ready to begin this meeting. Let me look back at my notes here and see if there was anything I was supposed to do before I turn it over to Peter Lee for the executive.
January 17th.
Okay. Madam Chair. Let's do the minutes from January 17th.
And actually, before we take a motion for those, I'd like to propose two amendments to them. First, on the first page of the minutes, Mr. Lee announced that there are going to be 4 advisory groups, not 5. And we love advisory groups, but we only have 4 right now. And on page 11, to revise the minutes to reflect the comments from Sherry Fields, Director of Government Relations of LA Care, who voiced support for the bridge plan, noting that they are exploring options 1 and 2. She also stated that the bridge plan will help reduce churning, as well as address the concerns of those who previously expressed opposition to the basic health program because it took enrollees out of the exchange. That's the correct statement of what she said. The minutes should be moved to reflect those corrections.
With that amendment, I would accept a motion for the adoption of the amended minutes.
So moved.
Is there a second? Is there any discussion or question of the staff? Is there any public comment or question modification proposal from the members of the public? Anyone on the phone, I would again say welcome to those of you that are participating with us by webinar, and you can follow the instructions thereon to participate with us if you have questions or comments. Thank you. Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm Dorina Wong, the Asian Pacific American Legal Center. I just wanted to add a recommendation that we had presented along with some of our Health Justice Network partners at the January 17th meeting. In addition to the web page being in the 11 additional Medi-Cal special languages, we also wanted it the web portal and the CalHERS, the online application in the CalHERS eligibility system to also be in those additional Medi-Cal threshold languages, you know, for many of the reasons to make sure that there's cultural and linguistic access. And we appreciated Dr. Ross's suggestion about Mr. Lee exploring the feasibility of the additional Medi-Cal languages on the website. And we would also add that it should also be explored, the web portal, the additional languages for the web portal should be explored as well.
Thank you, Dorina. Okay. We will modify the minutes to reflect that your request was for both the web portal as well as the documents. Seeing no other comment or question regarding the minutes, I'll call the roll. Belshe?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
The chair is aye. The minutes are adopted. Peter Lee, give us your executive director's report.
Great.
Please.
Thank you very much. And let's get our slides up, which are now appearing like magic. Thank you very much. And there's an arrow pointing right at me. Thank you. I start the board meetings usually with underscoring material the board's been provided. In addition to the comments from stakeholders on issues before us, there are about 8 or 9 reports that are I would commend to the public's consideration as well as the board's. The first is really a very exciting, I note this with congratulations to the chair, Diana Dooley, who helped lead the state in getting a award from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation to have a state innovation program to develop a planning grant for that. The state was awarded $2.7 million. We included the copy of the framing report for that. I'd note that Covered California is a partner in that effort. It aligns very well with our efforts. We talk a lot about the importance of payment being an engine for making sure patients get better care, right time, right place. We're excited about that. Congratulations to California. Also in our material is an update on the Choosing Wisely initiative. We presented on this at the last board meeting, and we look forward to coming to the future board meeting on potentials of more in-depth partnerships between Covered California and this initiative with medical specialty societies and Consumers Union. It's an announcement of medical specialty societies identifying 90 more tests and treatments that consumers need to look at. These are tests that often actually cause harm, CT scans that are unnecessary, that actually give huge doses of radiation, which are cancer risk, et cetera. And this is medical specialty societies working in partnership with leading consumer groups. Stay tuned for our potential involvement with that initiative. You'll hear more at our upcoming meetings. Also included are material from the Commonwealth Fund on how to look at confronting costs and have a high-performance healthcare system. Many of the initiatives they talk about are ones that we've been looking at in delivery reform. There's a few reports that provide good overviews and background to the Affordable Care Act as it's moving forward, one by the Commonwealth Fund on market reforms, one by the Congressional Research Service. And then there's a set of material that is very consumer-centric that is actually readable as well. So both by Consumers Union on looking at value-based insurance design, but also a suite of material from the Pacific Business Group on Health on consumer choice of health plan for exchanges. And again, if people have not looked at that, I encourage you to do that. I'm not recommending this as the former CEO of PBGH. It is great material. They go through 7 or so major choices that we will have before us, such as how to compare plans in display, how to use a cost calculator, dimensions of plan choice, searching for a doctor. I mean, these are issues that are very real, very much before CalHERS, as you hear about. But each of those research papers is concise, gets to the point, is based in evidence, and I think is a good model for sharing good evidence. Finally, we've shared material from Pricewaterhouse that they presented to the Pacific Business Group on public and private exchanges. I think it's an important window for the board to look at how large employers are looking at exchange-related issues, and understanding that is an important context, and it's a good fodder for background. With that, in terms of closed session items, the board had extended discussions on both personnel and contracting matters, most of which will be coming out in future announcements, but the one that I would announce now and then we'll be releasing publicly is the board resolved to change and update its contracting policies which up till now had required board contracts that exceeded $150,000 to come to the board for action, to expand the amount that is required for board action to be $1 million if they are competitively bid. And we will obviously be informing the board and the public about that. If they are not competitively bid, they would still need to come to the board if they're more than $150,000. And so we have updated our procurement policy at the board's direction with that resolution, and we'll be sharing that publicly on our website. With that, I'd like to turn now to a couple other announcements. Many of you know that this last, since our last board meeting, we had a major announcement or two. We'll be hearing later at this board meeting about the adoption that the board did to have standard benefit designs. We announced those publicly earlier this month. And the other thing we announced is our website. We are now online. We're online at coveragedca.com. We are also on Facebook. If you haven't liked us yet, shame on you. You will also be starting to see new web addresses for everyone at Covered California. Our web addresses, for those of you that track this, will no longer be the ever-so-memorable hbex.ca.gov. It will be covered.ca.gov. So you'll see our signature email addresses with that tag at the end. We are proud and excited to be part of the state of California, so we are still a .gov, but we want to reinforce our brand, which is Covered CA, Covered California. So you'll see that as our handle going forward. And the other thing I would note is a couple things on being online is, and this is, again, being seeking to move fast, nimbly, and right. We aren't going to get it right every time. I'll note that as we went online with our website, it is substantially disability accessible, but not entirely, and it is not totally compliant with what's called 508 compliance. We appreciate guidance and comments. We've gotten some from our friends. We are seeking to rectify that as we speak. A learning process. We appreciate your engagement. I would have rather never need constructive criticism, yet we will always need it, and we welcome it and appreciate it. I would note also, though, that when we launched coveragedca.com, whose phone's doing that? Just checking. We were excited to have fact sheets available in, I think, originally 7 languages, and we're building up to 13. But so we have 7 fact sheets that are available today, not just in, of course, Spanish and English, but in Farsi, in Hmong, in Mandarin. We're proud of that. We think it's important. That builds on focus groups we've been doing in more than a dozen languages with people from different cultures. So we hope you find this useful. We welcome and invite your comments and suggestions. It is a work in progress. It will be built upon and improved every month as we go between now and enrolling the many hundreds of thousands of people later this fall. The next note of announcement is in terms of a background of other things that have happened in the last month, which is we had a delegation of 5 of us that joined 17 other colleagues of ours. There are now 18 states that will have state-based exchanges. And up on the slide, you see a number of their logos. You know, they range from Colorado, Connecticut, D.C., Hawaii, et cetera. There are some big states there. I want to be very clear. We are by far the largest, but New York is one of those states which will have a state-based exchange. There are also some small states and districts that may have, you know, like Vermont and D.C., 600,000, which is, you know, the population of one of our smaller cities. I say that with great affection. I should be careful about that. We have a lot to learn from every one of these states. They have a lot to learn from us, and I think that it's we have developed a very good partnership relationship with these other states. We are meeting on a regular basis. We're sharing strategies with them. We're learning from them. At the same time, Diana Dooley and I just were yesterday in Washington for a meeting with our federal colleagues talking about how best to make sure that the 30-plus states that are using the federally facilitated marketplaces are also successful. We obviously are focusing on our day job, which is making sure we have health reform and the expansion of coverage happen as effectively as possible in California. But we are concerned and committed to helping the rest of the country also be effective at enrolling people in coverage. So we are actively working with, learning from, sharing lessons with our federal colleagues as well as other states across the country. Next up, and I'm going to note a proposal before the board that is not taking the form of a resolution, but is a proposal that we will solicit comment on when we get to the public comments portion, which is a good news and a good news proposal. As many of you know, we have held periodic board meetings outside of Sacramento, and that is a burden for some people who live in Sacramento. It is actually a bit of a challenge for our staff. In terms of managing board meetings. We are actually proposing to our board to no longer do that, to hold board meetings only in Sacramento, but to have an aggressive, and it gets much more aggressive, this series of town halls around the state. And at those town halls to have board members, and given, as you are familiar with our rules, at least two of them, or not at least two of them, with senior staff going around the state to talk about what is the progress of Covered California? How are we doing? Soliciting engaged input and comment, and doing that in town halls without, with all due respect, the rigmarole of full board meetings, without closed sessions being held there, without et cetera, those pieces. We have here a tentative town hall schedule. We look forward to announcing specific times as soon as next week on our listserv, which, by the way, does not have an E at the end. But we will put that out. So if you want to know the dates and times, if we adopt this, yet another reason to get on our listserv. Let me actually pause at this moment to see if board members have questions or want to state their initial thoughts with regard to this recommendation before going on to other items.
Just to underscore that one of the benefits of this approach, aside from the very important issue of managing and focusing staff resources, is it gives us really an undivided opportunity to engage with community stakeholders in area locations throughout the state. So it's an opportunity for us to continue to do our monthly work in a very focused way here in Sacramento, but also to get out and really dedicate concentrated time to hearing from community stakeholders around the state.
Thank you, Kim. Any other comments? I would only add that I've been very impressed with the number of people who have learned to navigate the web process of participating, and we do have a considerable amount of participation in these meetings. I'm struck by how many times I run into people that comment on having participated in the meetings, and I haven't seen their faces in the room. So we are very committed to engaging the broadest possible number and diversity of participation in the actual work of the board at the regular meetings. But I do think this will give us an appropriate and helpful way to bring more citizen participation throughout California. And I certainly, as one member, and I think my colleagues will do the same, to the extent that we can participate and have board engagement at each of these off-site town hall meetings, we are committed to doing that under the rules. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would note that, as you all know, there will be a lot more outreach. This is not our outreach program. And in particular, when we think about town halls, we will be having lots of town halls, in particular during open enrollment period. So this is foreshadowing a lot, but this is a more sort of formal town hall process we're speaking to. Next, many of you who have been with us for a year know that we'd used to pause and say, let's introduce the four people we hired last month. And they'd get to stand up, and we'd all applaud. But I would like, if any of the new Covered California staff who are on this list are in the room, please stand.
Good, they're all working.
Good, they're all working. Yes. Now, coming to board meetings is working too, Madam Chair. I would note you'll see a roster of people. We now have, as of February 28th, 138 staff. And I really think that we are very excited about the not by a long shot, just the numbers. It is a quality issue. We're having very good staff coming from a whole range of places that are committed to the vision and mission that the Covered California Board have detailed. And they're coming with excitement about joining us in achieving that vision of expanding coverage dramatically in California. With that, we have a number of updates and proposals, the first of which is actually not on the agenda, so we're going to sneak it in, but it is not an action item, and so, but people can still send me complaints later that it wasn't agendized. It is a report, an update of from NORC on looking at the small business marketplace from research that they've been doing. Larry Bai, can you please join us?
Yeah. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm just going to take the very briefest of minutes here to summarize some work that was done in November with the small business market. We actually went out and did a qualitative study of we interviewed insurance agents serving the small business market as well as small business decision makers themselves, which included, in the case of very small companies, owners, but in the case of slightly larger small businesses, benefit managers. And this will look familiar in terms of some of the other work we've been doing, but our objectives were to look at knowledge and awareness about health reform, general attitudes, interest in shopping in the covered California marketplace, the shop marketplace, as well as interest in actually enrolling in a plan, and then to continue our exploration of what's driving and what's going to most motivate enrollment, as well as barriers. We're looking at both sides of the equation. We did 8 focus groups in early November. The size of the companies represented were under 50. We did also 25 30-minute one-on-one interviews with agents, and these interviews were conducted across both populations in Sacramento, San Diego, and San Francisco. So in terms of what we learned, just very briefly some tidbits from this work. We learned, no surprise, that, and again, I want to just emphasize this is qualitative research, so we need to be careful about drawing sort of population-based conclusions about any of this. But what we learned was that white-collar companies that employed white-collar professionals in larger companies were more likely to be currently offering coverage. Small business owners and benefit managers have a really strong desire to provide coverage to their employees. At least these respondents did. Many viewed it as their sort of moral obligation. Many viewed it as a kind of milestone to which they strived in order to have a success. It was a sort of a mark of progress in terms of growing their firms if they were able to offer coverage. No surprise, the big concern is cost. This is what's keeping. We had about half of the folks in these interviews, half of these businesses were not currently offering coverage. No surprise, cost was the primary barrier. I think in some ways the most important thing we learned, or one of the most important things, was the amount of confusion and misinformation that's out there about reform and what's going to be required. I mean, I think the leading source of confusion at the beginning of the interview, when we hadn't provided respondents with any kind of background information about Covered California and how it was going to work, people really came into these interviews with the belief that they were going to be required, even at this size level, to provide insurance coverage and that there would be steep fines if they didn't. So that's kind of what folks came in with. A lot of skepticism at the beginning of the interviews, cynicism, outright opposition on the part of many of the small business owners, for reasons that weren't really unique. I think there are things things we understand are out there in terms of attitudes. However, over the course of the interview, as we began to layer more and more information on the group about how this was actually going to work, there was a pretty much a complete turnaround, and folks suddenly were much more positive about Covered California and what was going to be offered beginning in October. Everybody, as they learn, virtually every single respondent, as they learn more about their ability to go on to Covered California and do apples to apples comparisons in terms of shopping for plans, were very, very excited about doing that. Folks really began to see that this could essentially revolutionize the terribly frustrating experience for small business owners and benefit managers around shopping for insurance. It's right now, we heard compelling stories about how frustrating and difficult it is to do that. And folks saw here, particularly We talked about Orbitz and Expedia as sort of examples of how the shop exchange might work. People were very, very positive about that. By and large, insurance agents weren't terrifically positively viewed by many of these respondents. Some expressed a desire to work with an agent in terms of navigating the new exchange. Many, however, said that the ease with which this is going to be done would allow them to shop on their own, which is interesting. The insurance agents, I don't want to skip this. In terms of whether people would actually purchase insurance, there was division. The group is sort of divided. I hope about half of the folks said, yeah, you know, I really think that I might be able to do this. The tax credit was a particularly enticing incentive, as it was described in our materials, along with this idea that folks can shop and compare, and there was a perception that the competitive marketplace was going to hopefully produce better products. That's certainly not anything we claim, but that became clearly a perception that evolved over the course of these interviews. So a fair amount of interest in actually enrolling in a plan on the part of folks who currently were not offering one. However, on the other hand, some of the smaller businesses were still not sure they could afford it. So that even as we layered more and more information on about how this was going to work, there was still a contingent that doubted that they were going to be able to do it. What drives enrollment? Largely a desire to retain employees, no surprise really, desire to grow the business, to gain a competitive edge, and to reap the benefits of a new competitive marketplace. And so here's where people really began to believe that this is bound to bring us, from their perspective, more options, better prices. Those that came into the interviews already providing coverage were pretty clear that they were going to continue to do so because they thought it was important. They've managed to do it. They want to keep doing it, but they're hopeful that better products are going to be available moving forward. The agents were better informed than the small business owners, but also we were struck by how low their information levels were. They, too, were initially very skeptical about how this was going to work and what their role would be in it. Many came in to the interviews believing they were going to be excluded from the process. However, once it was explained to them that they could how they could interact with Covered California, they became really much more positive as the interviews unfolded and really began to see the exchange as a sales tool that they could use to go out and sell health insurance. And if anything, I think the agents were more optimistic than the small business owners about what the impact of Covered California was going to be in terms of more and more small businesses providing group coverage. And with that, I'll stop.
I'm going to remind both the board and the public at large that this is part of, we're doing ongoing deep research. We've talked a lot more about the individual market. There's other work that is ongoing in that to focus our outreach, education, marketing efforts that Larry has been helping lead. But we want to keep ongoing updates. This is the slice that's looking at the small business side. Are there any questions from the board before going on? Okay.
Thank you. And as a reminder to the public, we will have an opportunity for public comment at the conclusion of the executive director's report. Thanks, Peter. Next item.
Great. And again, this is a 5 slides that have 38 pages behind it and a lot of many, many hours of work, and that is going to be posted today on our website. The next item is a report on CalHERS, the California Healthcare Eligibility, Enrollment, and Retention System. We have Jim Brown and Keith Ketcher. Jim, CalHERS Project Director, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and board members. I'd just like to introduce Keith Ketcher, the Accenture Project Manager. Keith has been with us now for a couple of months and has taken over as the project manager over the team from delivering the system.
Can you move the mic up a little bit?
Move it up a little bit.
Thank you.
How's this? All right, so as we did with the prior project manager, we'll be actually reporting on CalHERS jointly. So I just wanted to start off today with kind of a review of our project timeline. And really what I want to call your attention on the timeline is as we have mentioned before, At the top of the chart, you see our six in yellow sprints as we are going through our development. And as you can see, we actually are active based on our timeline with four of them right now. The fourth one, Sprint 4, we're actually in more of a planning phase, but it just shows you how much we have going on in the development of the software right now. Concurrently, as you go down in the other rows, you can see the other how the releases kind of stack as far as release 1, 2, 2.5, and 3. And how we're actually in some of those releases have other activities that are concurrent with the development, such as the system testing and certainly assembly testing. So just trying to take some note on the overlapping and the concurrency of the project activities. I want to talk today a little bit about some project adjustments. Pretty much our job number one is to keep our eye on the date, you know, meet the goals of certainly bringing a lot of functionality to bear in our release 2 and release 3. Those are kind of our major releases in the shorter time frame up through January. So as we go through our design sessions and finalize decisions, we try to bring those decisions back and make sure that we're cross-checking, we're evaluating those changes, looking at anything new that may have been requested from the client side, the program side, and make sure that there's any impact to the schedule. Really trying to gauge the effort that's defined in these decisions, making sure we have the capacity to deliver to those timelines. As such, we've looked at this list based on the more recent decisions, some of the changes, and really we start the formulation of a list of features that we are going to defer to later releases.
Excuse me, Jim. If one of you has a BlackBerry that's on or something, are we picking up some?
I was thinking the same thing. I think one of the IT people have IT on them. There we go. He's disarmed himself, and now we'll see what happens. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
I have a pen. Not radioactive. So, just kind of want to walk down those features.
A context on this to remind everyone that CalHERS is a jointly managed project of Covered California and the Department of Healthcare Services. And we meet regularly in governance, and the CalHERS team brings to us issues for potential adjustment. You'll see in what Jim's going to walk through some issues which are big deal issues for the Department of Healthcare Services, some of which are big deal issues for Covered California, and some of which are big deal issues for both of us. Every one of these issues are deferrals that have been brought through to the steering committee, and we have approved deferral on, and so this is an announcement, and I will just, not to steal Jim's thunder, but note in particular on the issue of supplemental vision and dental plans that we sent out a notice yesterday morning to the many plans who have stated their intent to bid for supplemental benefits, both vision and dental, our continued interest and commitment to offering those products, but it wouldn't be day one. What day it is, we're in a review of with the CalHERS team, but we're committed to making sure that everyone that has already enrolled has the opportunity of getting those products, and that people that do enroll note that they'll be offered later. So we'll be displaying those issues. But I just want to note that the context of the decision process, again, are going to that joint governance body of DHCS, Department of Healthcare Services, and Covered California. So with that stealing your thunder, so to speak, Jim.
No, thank you, Peter. And basically, just to kind of add to that, I mean, what we're talking about is deferrals that are basically workload adjustments. Since we can't move our dates, we've got to really try to, you know, figure out how to map the work to the time frames that we have. All this functionality that we have on this list will still be developed and delivered. And we are, as Peter stated, still trying to assess now which release does it really align best with so we can provide an accurate date in future meetings. But obviously in the list, it is the supplemental vision dental plans. Those were pretty much new functionality that we had a change request to incorporate it within CalHERS. It's the online filings of appeals and exemptions, which certainly we will have some workarounds built in to be able to attend to those as they're filed. Those particular features will be built, but we feel right now, at least from the timeline of testing, that we may not have the window of testing to cover the testing of that functionality. Also, Medi-Cal plan selection. This is actually trying to move Medi-Cal plans from the HCO functionality into our system so that they can actually select a Medi-Cal plan within CalHERS. And we have at least temporarily has tried to align that with this new bridge plan functionality, because it does affect the same functionality. It does play with the same interfaces with MEDS, so it might be a little bit more fruitful to just try to align that functionality together and deliver it together. And the last one that I want to mention is the authorized representative. And within the scope of an authorized representative, there was a number of different roles that were requested to be an authorized representative. But the bottom line, we'll have basic authorized representative where somebody can come in and certainly act as a delegate for a person and provide all the functionality for them, but we can't get down to the various levels to create additional roles. So I'm going to hand it off to Keith to take you through a little bit of design and development update.
All right. Thanks, Jim. So good afternoon. Part of what I want to walk through you today is to give you a progress report on our team's activity in designing and building the CalHERS system. What you see in front of you here is a progress tracker of our design activity. The blue lines represent the plan progress week to week, and the red bars represent the actual progress that we've made. So what you can see on the far right bar is that we've slipped a bit behind plan. We are working through with our program sponsors on some open design decisions, and we're expecting those to be resolved in a short time frame so that we can close that gap. As we move on to the build, this is building the software, and again, the blue line is the planned progress and the red is the actual. We're generally on track with our development. This is showing you status of our software that will be planned for release in the summer and then again in October for open enrollment. And so you can see we're on track here. We began system test several weeks ago, and so that's been going well and it's in progress. And as we continue to incrementally add more software to our system test cycles, we'll just continue climbing the line of progress here. Next, I'd like to give you an update on our usability activities. And as you know, the objective of our usability activities is to design our web page layouts and page flows so that the system works efficiently for our users. Through last month, we've conducted field studies and lab testing, and these field studies are essentially interviews with people who are likely consumers of Covered California. And similar to what Larry described on the small business interviews, we asked them questions about their experience with the healthcare system and in selecting insurance plans. And for people who had accounts with their insurers, we'd actually ask them to log on and we'd watch the way they interact with the system and interview them about what works well for them and what challenges they have. The lab testing is where we take our current designs for CalHERS, and we also take established existing private exchanges in front of people. And again, we run these by them, and paying particular attention to our plan shopping features. And we like to understand how the users narrow down plans so that they can make their decisions about which plan is best for them. What's coming up, and it's really kind of already in progress, we're taking the results of that lab testing, we've rolled it into our CalHERS designs, and we are, there's really multiple streams of research that's going on around our plan shopping, and we're rolling that into our CalHERS designs, we're reviewing it with our sponsors, and we're rolling it into the system that we're building. We received in late January the most recent guidance from the federal government on the single streamline application, so we're rolling that into our designs as well. And finally, the Covered California marketing team is developing standards for approved colors and logos, and we'll be incorporating that into our design starting next month.
So in the past month, we've certainly been continuing with our interactions with our federal partners. In January, we had a preliminary design review It was a two-day review. It really focused mainly on more of the programmatic aspects of what CalHEARS is there to support. Certainly meetings that talked more about how the processes will work from the exchange side. But the minor part of the meeting was to talk some of the IT topics, and that included more conversations around our integrated work plan, their test approach, the org change management effort, and how we were planning on working with our partner agencies to implement. And we did receive a progress letter in February commending us for our efforts in that review. And we also continued. We had subsequent webinars with CISIO and CMCS to kind of take them through a very detailed walkthrough and of our integrated work plan, which is really the work plan that captures all the activities for not only CalHEARS, but for the MEDS aspects of our projects and the three SAW systems and any of our partner efforts. And then finally, we took them through a detailed walkthrough of our high-level contingency plan that really takes each of the risks that we have relevant to what would happen if one of our interface partners were not up on time. What happens if a certain piece of functionality wasn't up on time, and how to create some contingency plans around that. And their comments were that they thought that was one of the better contingency plans they had seen to date. So we were quite proud of that. From a stakeholder engagement, continuing with our public comment process, we had posted one of our business service definitions document, and we received a number of comments on that document. We have been going through the analysis on it, and we'll be posting a response on the Cover California website that will include kind of a breakdown of the comments received and our responses. Included the categories, as at least the analysis is kind of pointing to right now, you know, some of them basically that the BSD is being updated to address the comments. Others are subject to policy questions, and others may be for final design. But certainly, again, thanking everyone that's been participating in that process and sending us some very valuable input. And finally, from a stakeholder perspective, we are planning a webinar in early March to kind of go over the usability information on plan choice architecture that Keith was mentioning also. And as a final wrap-up point, one of the other things that we completed in January, we did move to our final project site. So that is our second move in so many a number of months, but we are all moved in and situated and happy to be in our final resting spot. So help us focus on our activities.
Are there any questions from the board? Bob.
Thank you. Jim, a couple of questions. One is specific to the user experience lab testing. I'm hoping that we're not recreating new ground after the UX 2014 considerable work on user experience, and I know Accenture has mentioned in the past they've been relying upon and using some of that UX 2014 experience. So this is in addition to and not duplicative, right?
This is information where we take some information out there that has been based on the UX 2014 and gaining some input on how the evolution is going as far as how the usability features are being presented. So it's kind of taken to the next step and then getting their feedback on that. But basically all the usability stuff that we're working today starts with UX 2014.
Say that again.
All of our usability efforts to date really has been starting with that foundational piece of the UX 2014.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
And then the second question, Jim, you still seem remarkably composed. I want you to refer me to your Zen master. But what, in terms of the CalHEARS schedule, what single issue keeps you awake at night that you're concerned about? What's your biggest timeline concern that you can share with 200 of your closest friends?
Not counting those on the list.
What are you worried about?
I want to give you two, because the first one is just the obvious one. It's the aggressive schedule. And we have certainly been working from a number of different angles to continue to attack the aggressiveness of that schedule, come up with mitigation plans, contingency plans, and everything. So that's the given. As we tell our feds, our schedule is red and is going to stay that way till we get to the finish line. The second are the decisions. Decisions in the form of design decisions that we're working to finalize, and I think we've actually been getting very good progress on those decisions. But the threat that there are still some outstanding decisions that could affect how we get to that, especially the October date, that's still something that bothers me. I think we're doing our best to work with each of the different groups that some of those decision points rest with, but there are some things outside of that, such as, you know, certain legislation and then federal guidance. And we've been working together, you know, between DHCS and Covered California to make sure that we try to make the best decisions we can make now. And then as regulations come in and things get finalized, that we look upon those and try to decide, is change to CalHERS really necessary at this point in time, or can we actually talk, you know, more from the angle of it's good enough for now and we'll fix it post-production? But those types of decisions certainly concern me.
So it sounds like the politics and the bureaucracy of those decision that decision pathway troubles you more than any technological any technologically based dilemmas or challenges.
Well, and mainly from the angle that we knew that the technological challenges, more or less the delivery of the system itself, was a very aggressively mapped out scenario to start with. It was just a tough challenge. Certainly, we've encountered a few issues around our software development that are making it a little bit more challenging from that angle, but I think we do have a work plan that attends to that and a testing approach that fits the need from that angle. So my report right now is that we still are on target from that angle, but it's a challenge to maintain that, but we're doing it. It's the unknowns as far as the decisions, how they might fall out.
Are there any other questions, comments?
I just want to thank you for your presentation and for your steady and thoughtful leadership and counsel on all this. I just want to echo Bob's comments to say I'm really glad to hear your comments about the user 2014 experience. User experience 2014 being used as kind of the foundation. A lot of good work that was done by our state and many partners as well as other states. Certainly we're going to need to make sure it works for California now in practice, but I'm really glad to hear that you're leveraging the design elements, the work that has been done to accelerate this incredibly important public-facing component of the application.
Thanks, Kim.
That's it. Next up. Yes, sir.
If I could, thank you both very much. And this seems in the weeds, in the details, but I really appreciate the board's attention to this, is that having an IT system that's up, that has the eyes on, that we have, that the CalHERS team's eyes on, is critical to our success. And we're committed to keep on bringing this every board meeting, going through how we're hitting those stair charts, et cetera, and we have eyes on to make sure that we're up and running when we need to be. So thank you.
Next up, federal proposed rules update.
Great. Thank you. And so we now, I believe, will have Katie Ravel presenting on federal proposed rules updates. Katie.
Thank you. And in the interest of time, I'll go through this pretty quickly. This is our monthly update. So this is a familiar chart, but we've broken it into two pieces because we did have in February some final rules released. And then the second chart you see there is pending rules that are draft rules that are open for comment. So the first one, this is a final rule. This finalizes the affordability test for relatives of an employee who receives employer-sponsored coverage. The thing we want to note here is that if an employee has an employer-sponsored plan that's affordable to that employee, the test there is on the employee's share of cost. It's not on the family's share of cost. So the family may actually have a share of cost that's unaffordable that exceeds this 9.5% of household income. In that case, they wouldn't be eligible for premium tax credits. This is something we commented on when this rule was in draft. It unfortunately wasn't changed in the final rule. In terms of the key issue for Covered California, just to echo what Jim said, for all of these rules, as they get finalized, we need to incorporate them into our eligibility and enrollment in CalHERS processes that are under development. The next rule is an HHS rule. This was actually finalized, released in final form last Thursday. So this is a final rule for essential health benefits, actuarial value, and accreditation. The essential health benefits, as we reported previously, are for non-grandfathered plans in both the individual and small group market, and this applies inside and outside of the exchange. The thing we want to note here is that this rule finalizes a timeline for QHPs to be accredited in the exchange with a phase-in for certain health plans, including Medicaid plans. Next one we'll move to. rules for exchanges related to eligibility, appeals, and application assistance, among other things. This was an HHS rule. The comments were due last Thursday. We did submit comments with Department of Healthcare Services. You have those comments in your packet. A couple things to note, and we have a laundry list up there of things we did comment on. A couple things I would call out. They did, in this rule, elaborate a little bit on verification and appeals for employer minimum essential coverage. This is something that we'll have to verify, and if an individual has an affordable offer of minimum essential coverage from an employer, they're not eligible for our premium tax credits. The federal HHS made available a federal service to actually verify this coverage. This is something that we know we're going to struggle with since California Today doesn't have an electronic database to verify this information. So we can rely on the federal government to verify this and also to conduct the appeals for it if an employer wants to appeal that determination that the coverage that they're offering is unaffordable. So we did thank them for that and say that we're strongly considering using that service. Another thing to call out, they define, as you see in this second bullet here, a category of certified application counselors, which are tied to counselors that would perform application assistance in Medicaid programs. It's a little unclear from the rule. This appears to be something that would be an unpaid assister, clinic-based, potentially, or provider-based. So we did ask HHS for clarification about exactly what defines this category of certified application counselors, and we'll use that information to see how it tracks to our hierarchy of assisters. Another one to talk about, this is an IRS rule. Comments are due in March on shared responsibility for employers. This defines large employers, puts in regs the definition of large employers and full-time employees, large employers being employers of 50 or more. This is an issue between the employer and the IRS where it impacts California. When individuals apply, they'll be asked to tell us whether they have employer-sponsored coverage and who their employer is, and we'll have to send that information to the IRS. So what we're waiting for here is additional detail from the IRS about this data-sharing process, which will, again, be important for our CalHERS interfaces. The last two I'll mention have to do with minimum essential coverage. The first one is an HHS rule, comments due in March on this rule. This lists exemptions from the individual mandate and talks about what defines minimum essential coverage. This is important to us because we'll have to verify minimum essential coverage and we'll have to determine exemptions from the individual mandate if you have coverage. The final one is a similar IRS rule about the penalty if you don't maintain minimum essential coverage. So it defines the responsibility for an individual to maintain coverage, talks about the penalty if you don't, and then discusses criteria for receiving an exemption from the coverage requirement. And again, this is important to us because we will be granting those exemptions. One more issue to mention, and this is not a rule. This was a frequently asked question document that was released on February 8th by CMS. We just wanted to bring it to your attention, and you have the document in your packet. It relates to the basic health program. So the question was, when will the program be operational? And the response from federal HHS is that they expect to issue rules in 2013, final guidance in 2014. So a program, a basic health program in a state, could be operational in 2015. So I'd be happy to take any questions you have.
So if there's any questions on those matters, and I would note we, again, had a very good partnership with the Department of Healthcare Services and did joint comments on some of the regs that are out and some of the others we're looking at to the extent to which we make comments on those that are still outstanding. The next thing I'd like to introduce Katie to move to next is to, and this is a discussion item, not an item for action, to present what we're looking at doing with regard to both employee and assisters and sort of background checks. I'd want to remind the board that this is in a broader context of for both our staff who are at the service center and assisters that we certify, we will have a robust system that looks at selection in the case of our staff, hiring, but otherwise selection of people that want to be assisters so they reflect the background and diversity of the state, training programs, that we look at integrating across training with curriculum developed that we have for our service center, but also to cut across these programs and potentially in concert with what other parts of the state are doing, such as the Department of Insurance, Department of Healthcare Services, Department of Managed Healthcare. And finally, having monitoring and oversight of once people are on and selected, whether as staff, having ongoing monitoring, they're doing the right thing, certified assisters, having ongoing monitoring. These two issues, though, that relate to these is, as part of bringing people on, what background checks are we either required to have or think is appropriate? On both of these, I want to appreciate comments we received from the Department of Insurance, which on a whole range, not just on background check, but on the issues of monitoring, training, had some very thoughtful comments that have been helpful to us. With that, Katie?
Thanks, Peter. And I'll just note that you have three supporting materials in your binder on this, and they're available also on the website. You have a paper on the employee screening, a paper on assister screening, and draft state regulations on these recommendations. So just to start with an overview, federal guidance does require that state exchanges protect and safeguard consumer information, including the types of information you see listed there, personal identifying information, a name and address, a social security number, personal health information, and federal tax information. So to be in compliance with the federal guidance, we need to implement background checks, as Peter noted, to identify individuals with a demonstrated history of abuse of personal information or other offenses that might lead us to believe that we shouldn't disclose our enrollees' sensitive information to them. So what we're recommending here, and both for our staff and for assisters, is a fingerprint-based background check. We're proposing to require all service center employees working in the areas of eligibility and enrollment, employees working in the area of information technology, including those with access to our CalHERS system, and assisters be subject to background checks. We would perform background checks prior to hiring, and then we'd also conduct periodic rescreening. For employees who work in these areas that have already been hired, we will work with our federal colleagues to determine a process for now doing a background check. Disqualifying offenses here would include a conviction or pending charges of a felony or a misdemeanor related to theft, fraud, dishonesty, or crime of moral turpitude. Mitigating factors would be considered. That could include rehabilitation from the offense and the age and the specifics of the offense. We're proposing that background check costs will be paid by Covered California for any employee that we're potentially looking to hire and by the assister enrollment entity for assisters. We need our next steps here. We need legislative authority and we need to adopt regulations to implement this program. So our next step would be to provide technical assistance to the legislature to draft the required statutory language, and then we would bring back to you in a revised fashion, if we receive comments, the regulations at the March board meeting for adoption at that time.
And the one thing before asking the board for either comments or questions on this before taking public comment, one of the things we wrestled with most in this area is not the importance of doing background checks, and having mitigation factors, which we look forward to comment on, but the issue of who pays, just to be really crass and direct. And as you note, the recommendation is that we pay for staff and for independent assisters, the entity that is their sponsor pays for them. The cost is estimated to be about $65 per, and that's for the fingerprinting and background check together, which is about one paid enrollment. Again, we're paying $58 per enrollment. And to have us pick up the $1.4 million of not knowing how many people they are, how many it would be, who do we subsidize it for, we thought it was a reasonable way to have folks invest, so to speak. But we also have some concerns because we recognize that many of the groups will be sponsoring these programs don't have a lot of money on hand. We wrestle with this quite a bit, but we still think it's the right recommendation. And again, we look forward, I'm sure we'll hear public comment on that, but wanted to let the board, we gave this a lot of thought and consideration. Any questions or comments from the board before we then open this, go to the next area before we have public comment on the whole range?
Thank you, Katie, and look forward to hearing from our colleagues about their reaction to this issue and recommendation. Just in terms of clarification, so federal guidance is saying that we need to protect and safeguard consumers from unauthorized and illegal access to or disclosure of personal identifying information, et cetera. Do the feds give us some flexibility in terms of how to comply with that, or are they requiring specifically background checks, security screening, fingerprinting, et cetera?
I'm looking to a lifeline here.
Yeah, so that was one
is a group effort.
Yeah, that was one question, and then secondly, and Tien, you're perfect, because my second question was going to be, this is not a new policy objective and interest on the state's part. So, for example, with Healthy Families, how has that program handled a similar interest in protecting and safeguarding consumer information?
So from your Tien Lam, Deputy Director of Eligibility and Enrollment, and we are all family here at Covered California, and we support the work of each other. So that's why I'm up here responding to your more technical question, Ms. Belche. So in your first question about the federal government, our interpretation is that it's pretty explicit, that we do have to do our due diligence in ensuring that individuals who have access to people's protected information, particularly information related to, you know, IRS data, do have to go through a formal background check to assess and determine that, you know, the information that these individuals will have access to will be protected and will be safeguarded. So that's our interpretation from the federal perspective, that there's not a whole lot of flexibility, but it's pretty direct on this being a particular requirement.
But if I could, is it, we don't think it's specifically that it would need to be background checking and fingerprinting. So the brief looked at both of those options, the strengths and benefits of going what we think is a step further. The feds would probably support a quote-unquote mere background check. Is that fair?
That's fair, but the background check is very limited. Right. It's only based off of county history and county records, whereas the fingerprinting opens it up more to statewide records as well as through federal agencies.
And with regard to Mr. Mibb background?
Yes, and I was going to get there. I just wanted to pause momentarily to make sure there were no follow-up questions on that particular issue. And from a Mr. Mibb perspective, Mr. Mibb currently does not, in their enrollment entity and certified application assistance role, require any background checks or fingerprinting. There are certain, you know, information that as an enrollment entity or certified application assistor signs up that they have to make sure that they keep the individual's information protected and safe. Unlike Covered California, Mr. Mibb doesn't require, when people are applying for coverage, for people to have access to their Social Security number. A Social Security number is not a requirement in the world of Healthy Families. However, for Covered California, individuals who are wanting to apply for coverage are required to furnish Social Security numbers, which is therefore slightly different. And then also in the world of Mr. Mibb today, there's no verification process directly tapped into the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, where that information is something that we will be verifying for all eligibility determinations for Covered California subsidy programs. So that's the difference between the two programs and why we felt that it was very important for the assisters as well as our service centers to go through some sort of background check, and we're recommending fingerprinting because it is more robust.
Yeah, thank you. I look forward to hearing the public comment on this issue as well. I think a couple letters may have come in. In fact, a couple letters did come in on this issue. And the two concerns I have, one, Peter, just from a cost-benefit perspective, is this cost, regardless of who has to bear the cost, really worth it? I'm not convinced that it is, and we all want public programs run with, and publicly funded programs run with some degree and sense of integrity, of course, but I just don't know at $75 a pop whether the value really is there for us. My mind is still open on that. And secondly, if we do go that route, I hope we don't go overboard, and I'm not sure how to define overboard, but I'll give you one possible example. You know, for a lot of the grassroots and community-based organizations for whom we're going to depend upon to do outreach with hard-to-reach populations and communities, you know, in Richmond, in South Los Angeles, in Salinas, in Fresno, you know, people will have misdemeanors on their record, and they're trying to make their way back into a positive opportunity pathway. And cities like New York and others have banned this box. or variations thereof. So felonies, I guess I could see. Misdemeanors, I'm not so sure. But you know, I'm, my mind is open on this point. I'm just raising those questions because I'm just not sure that I know it sounds good, but when you start thinking about either us or some agency or individuals bearing the cost, you know, it adds up.
And Bob, you're speaking specifically to the policy decision as to require fingerprint-based crackdown checks, not only for our own employees, but for assisters.
Yes.
The equivalent of our certified application.
Yes, yes. Thank you for clarifying.
With
yes,
families.
Yes.
If I could just, I'll respond somewhat for staff, is that first, the costs are real costs, but we think it's very important that we're able to communicate to the entire state and the 5 million people who will be using potentially assisters that these are folks they can rely on giving their most absolutely personal information, which can be subject to fraud. I think your comments are very well taken, Dr. Ross. I think we look forward to comments on specific suggestions about when you say what are offenses that would be appropriate or inappropriate offenses to say these are what would trigger the prohibition, as well as how to consider mitigation or some of the things that we've certainly been looking at in terms of the what would be the triggers for saying this is the sort of offense that would be problematic. The cost we recognize, even $65 is a substantial amount of money. I'd remind the board that we are not charging for training. Training is something we'd be providing at no cost to individuals. We aren't saying that people have to pay to be an assister to have a potential substantial income stream from doing that, but this would be the one financial direct financial barrier. No? Okay, great. Thank you very much. And again, this is not an action item today. We're taking comment on this, public comment now, as well as written comment, which we welcome in the next 2 weeks to revise our recommendation to come for board action at the next meeting. Next, we have with Mr. David Panach, a legislative update. David.
Thank you, Peter. Here we go. Well, I'd like to start with just a quick update on where we are with the health reform special session. As you know, the governor called a special session on January 24th, and there are three key elements of that special session that I just want to highlight. And legislation has been introduced, and bills are moving in different ways. So the first broad category I want to talk about are the Medi-Cal expansion bills. So there are two, one by the Speaker, one by Senator Hernandez and the pro tem. The Speaker's bill has already moved out of the Assembly Health Committee and was also passed by the Assembly Appropriations Committee, which is sort of a reflection of how quickly the legislature is moving on these bills. The Medi-Cal expansion legislation really has a variety of core elements. The key, the central and perhaps the most complicated element of that is is how we handle the childless adult expansion that is part of the Affordable Care Act expansion. But there are also a number of other elements to it. Foster care, how you do the expansion for foster care kids up to age 26, and a variety of streamlining rules that are related to MAGI. So the administration has language that they are now working with the legislative staff on and members as this sort of moves forward. And I'll have more information for you at the next month on this one. Second major category are the individual market reform bills. And so, again, there are two that are identical. AB 1X2 by Assemblymember Pan and SBX12 by Senator Hernandez. The key for us in this is as you may have recalled from the last couple of board meetings when we've talked about the individual market reforms, is how these bills handle the geographic rating region issue. In the legislation that was passed last year on small group, there were 19 rating regions that were adopted in the small group market legislation. In the individual market bill, unfortunately the governor vetoed the legislation. There was not an issue related to the number of rating regions. last November, covered California, when we did our solicitation for our QHP process, we adopted the 19 rating regions. And so at this stage, it would be extremely disruptive for if the legislature were to change the rating regions that are incorporated into that legislation. And last week, I did have the opportunity to provide some testimony to both the Senate and Assembly Health Committees on what the nature of that disruption would be. But generally, we believe that it could result in a 3 or 4 month delay in our ability to move forward on the QHP process. So it's very serious. We are working with the legislature to so that the rules that are adopted are consistent with our solicitation, and I'm optimistic that we will get there. And finally, there's the issue of the Medi-Cal bridge, which I think I'd like to talk about when we get to the bridge discussion. Last Friday was the bill introduction deadline. There were a whole bunch of bills that were introduced. We're still wading through them. Many of them are spot bills, and again, I'll have more information for you next month. And that's my report.
Any questions to David on, and again, if you could hold bridge for that, will be actually as part of the qualified health plan contracting discussion. I would remind the board that the bridge program is the one action item on the agenda today, as opposed to discussion, stage setting for future decisions, with the exception, of course, of adjournment.
She's back, so we got to behave now.
Exactly. okay, next up, we have Sarah Soto Taylor to give you an update on the Outreach and Education Grant Program. Again, I'd remind folks that we are looking at what we often call a bottom-up and a top-down outreach program. The core to that bottom-up is the Outreach and Education Grants Program. Sarah.
Thank you. And also, as a reminder, during last month's board meeting, we had an agenda item, Agenda Item 7, which includes a more detailed presentation about the Outreach and Education Program, so folks can refer to that. It is posted up on our website. And just as background and as a reminder to folks, the Outreach and Education Grant Program, the main objective and goals is to educate eligible Californians about Covered California and to collect leads for assisters in the service center who will be performing application assistance. We want to ensure participation of organizations with trusted relationships throughout the state with the uninsured markets that represent the cultural and linguistic diversity of the state. Towards that end, we are looking for cost-effective programs that promote and maximize enrollment, and certainly that would be able to disseminate clear, accurate, and consistent messages to our target audiences. On January 25th, we released the grant application, $43 million program. $40 million has been set aside for the individual outreach and education grants. And then an additional $3 million has been aside to target small businesses that are eligible to purchase coverage through our Small Business Health Options Program. We hope to award anywhere between 100 to 150 community-based grant awards, ranging anywhere from $250,000 up to $1 million. We had a bidders conference on February the 6th. Over 650 individuals attended that webinar. We also have a formal question and answer period that is currently going on. Today is the last day to submit those questions and answers, and we have been posting the answers on a flow basis, and we anticipate posting the last answers by Friday. Part of the application process is a non-binding letter of intent to apply. We received about 300 of those from organizations who plan on applying for the individual target population pools, and another 50 that plan on applying for the SHOP pool. Of those entities that submitted those letters of intent to apply, most indicated that in their applications, they will be proposing outreach and education activities in English and Spanish, and then this chart reflects the other distribution of those languages that will be proposed. In the letters of intent to apply, we recognize that there is a wide interest from all parts of the state. We received at least one letter of intent to apply from each county, and over 94 entities expressed interest in Los Angeles County alone. Part of the outreach and education grant program was also a potential opportunity to partner with private foundations. Recently, staff had the opportunity to meet with six of those foundations, and we began starting the discussions, identifying key common priority areas, and also discussed the possibility of handing off to foundations proposals that perhaps we would not be able to fund due to limited resources. We also discussed with the foundation's participation in the evaluation process, and these will be ongoing discussions that we will be having with our foundation partners. The timeline for the grant program is noted here on this slide. The next major milestone is Monday, March the 4th, in which the grant proposals are due. We hope to award grants at the end of April, and then after that, quickly moving into the training of staff from those organizations that are selected, and also conducting a gap analysis to identify any specific regions throughout the state or target populations that will be the focus of the second round or second cycle of grant applications that are noted here. And that concludes my overview of where we are with the grant application.
Great. Sarah, thank you very much. The one thing I want to add to that, if I could be so bold, is we had scheduled also originally in calendar to discuss partnership program updates to look at a partnership program. So I wanted to, folks have seen this, we have withdrawn as a staff a recommendation we were considering to change how we would deal with paid assisters. So we had before the board, we didn't get to it for discussion at the last meeting, a proposal to revise the program to actually have treat as potentially paid assisters those that had retail clinics. Staff, after due consideration, has withdrawn that recommendation, so it's not up for action, and it's one that we're looking at a whole range of outreach and education efforts. One of the things that Sarah did not speak to much, but I think that we've talked a lot to the grant applicants. We're very excited that we've had 650 groups who participated in the webinar, over 300 stating intent to bid. As I'd remind people, Sarah noted we anticipate providing maybe 100 awards. That would mean 200 to 500 folks that are very interested not being grant recipients. We want to be very, very active partners with everyone, providing support in collateral material, coordination, et cetera. So not getting a grant does not mean not being an active partner with us in our efforts. And so we'll be coming back and talking a lot more about those community network partnership opportunities and the fact that not getting funding to be a grant recipient doesn't mean those aren't groups we look forward to working with very actively. Are there questions to Sarah first before we turn it open for public comment in general on the executive director's report?
Question on what you just said.
Yeah.
The discussion on potential partnership with retailers, is that withdrawn from this agenda or withdrawn?
Withdrawn.
No discussion?
No discussion.
I mean,
you can discuss, is staff don't think that we should change the payment policy the board previously adopted. So the board action was going to be to actually pay for in-person assistance from entities that were providers, including pharmacies. We don't recommend making that change, so it's not, you can talk about it
understood.
As much as you care to, but it's not before the board for action.
Understood. Is there will there be future discussion about ways in which we might partner with retail outfits?
Sure.
Okay, do not pat me on the head.
I mean, what will come before the board, I think, is more details on our outreach education programs that is not just about retail, but we talk often about wanting to reach out where people live, shop, work, play, and pray, and getting updates on that. And the anchor to that is the bottom-up community grants program, but it will also be more broad in terms of whether it's working with technology companies, retail sites, et cetera.
So that will come back to us.
Yeah, absolutely. Any questions of Sarah, who has fled the podium? So not since.
Kim.
Quick question. This is
board approved a $43 million initiative to support, you were saying, between 100 and 150 organizations? That's the general
That's
expectation.
Generally what we're anticipating.
So in terms of the two cycles, can you give us a sense of this initial notice of intent to award in April? What percentage of that $43 million is expected to be invested relative to the second cycle?
It's hard to say because really what's driving that decision is the actual proposals that come in.
Mm-hmm.
What's presented in those proposals, we are looking for innovative ways to reach our target population. And so depending on those proposals, we will be looking at the cycle two. There are also other factors versus geography and target population. If a particular proposals are not hitting limited English proficiency target populations that we know we want to target, that'll be part of the decision-making process.
The other thing, if I could add to that, and I want to again appreciate Sarah and her team leading this, we actually had a very good common discussion with, I think it was 8 foundations from around the state that were interested in potentially partnering with us in their local geographic areas, particularly regional foundations that might want to be involved in a second cycle to see if they could work with us to support community groups. And it was a very good outreach. We reached out to 38 foundations around the state. We have obviously some foundations like the Endowment, which have stated great leadership in terms of this historic opportunity. We found the same embrace and interest from other foundations as well. So that's another one of the cycle two opportunities that we're still exploring with foundations. But I think it depends on where the gaps are, what we do in cycle two.
Bob.
Yeah, Peter, just a clarifying question on the outreach support as a hypothetical. So if we were able to be more efficient in other areas of our level two grant, federal grant funding, and we found it necessary to expand the grants program as the year begins to unfold, could we move dollars from other areas of the level two grant if we're efficient in those areas to this program, for example, if we needed to expand it?
Yeah. Couple things. We are an evidence-based organization, and I think we want to see how effectively spent is this money and how effectively spent is other money to promote outreach and education. I would think it would be hard to know that until we're well into the work they're doing. I think looking at 2014, what do we see? These, and it's important, as Sarah noted, these awards are awards for, in essence, 18-month periods to cover 2 rounds of open enrollment. One, if grant recipients do not perform well to what they said they would, they may get defunded for the second round of open enrollment, not go into 2014's open enrollment for 2015. But also, we will look at where our investments are paying off. And if this is an area where it's paying off, we would absolutely bring to the board the action to spend more money here. And if certain other types of outreach is leveraging more uninsured to get insured, we'd say let's move money around there. So we absolutely have the ability to move money around, and we'll be bringing to the board the evidence.
Any other comments? Thank you very much,
Thank
Sarah.
You.
Any other comments or questions from the board before we open up for public comment on the executive director's report?
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the board. Autumn Ogden with California Coverage and Health Initiatives. And CCHI would like to report on the fingerprinting background. We are cognizant of Cover California's need to ensure program integrity and ensure public safety and the desire to do so through background checks and fingerprinting. However, our experience with years of engaging in outreach and enrollment work on behalf of the state of California has shown us that ensuring program integrity and consumer protections does not require that assisters pass the very high hurdle of federal background checks with fingerprinting. That said, many of our organizations do conduct background checks on employees. However, again, we believe that fingerprinting of assisters is an unnecessary and expensive process that will complicate and prolong the process of getting assisters prepared to begin enrolling the public. It will serve to create an additional barrier to wide participation by the community-level organizations. In order to avoid creating unnecessary barriers to entry into the program by potential assister enrollment entities, we recommend that Covered California assume the cost of the first-year background check should they require them and fingerprinting, and then after the first year evaluate their effectiveness of the policy. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Helen Roth Dowden, SEIU, Local 1000, the State Workers Union. We've been talking to your staff about the background checks and the fingerprinting, and it suggested there's already a number of areas in the government code where these are required for other departments. And as you look at this, possibly replicating what's already in the law and what's already required would probably cause the least amount of disruption. So we would suggest that you look at those policies that are in those departments, and a number of them have already this is a requirement, and use that as a guideline. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. My name is Fatima Morales, and I'm here on behalf of Community Health Councils, representing the LA Access to Coverage Coalition, which is based out of LA County with 40 organizations, and the Covering Kids and Families Coalition, which is a statewide coalition of over 70 partners. And much as was highlighted by the Greenlining Institute and California Coverage and Health Initiatives, we're very concerned over the fingerprinting and background checks as a requirement for us sisters. As was mentioned earlier, this is not a requirement currently today for CAAs, and as an organization that has worked with CAAs and that truly believes that CAAs can really step up and fill the role of the of assisters in person or navigators, this is a new process that many of these organizations would have to implement, and you know, we're just concerned that that would really pose a barrier to a lot of organizations who might otherwise be interested in being assisters. And so at the very least, we would request that you not require this upfront for the first year. Also, the cost is a big barrier. I know that the in the brief it indicates that the assumption is organizations would recoup this money. However, with organizations that employ a number of assisters, again, how long would it take to recoup, given that reimbursement is based on a successful application, not an applicant? And so just when you think about the cost to organizations, this is something that may prohibit them from participating. Whether or not you've reached a decision regarding liability insurance, I guess that's another concern for us, is just the number of additional costs that assister entities might be required to incur in order to just apply to become navigators or assisters. And so we would, echoing our partners' comments, really encourage you to reconsider and not require fingerprinting immediately, at least for assisters at this time, but really engage CAAs and other entities that are already doing this work and really ask them how this would impact their organizations. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Nisette Short with the California Dental Association. Back to the CalHEARS report and the decision to delay the benefit for the adult supplemental benefit offering. We just want to encourage you and your staff to talk with stakeholders about the implementation of this and some of the decisions that still need to be made about how this is going to be implemented. Obviously, this could have an impact on consumers and consumer behavior, and so it just might be a good idea to kind of bring some of us together and have some of those conversations as you make some of the decisions moving forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Young. I'm here today for the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of California. I will not reiterate, but second the point that Micah made to set us off on the role of agents in the whole marketplace. Number two, on the subject of background checks, we strongly support the recommendation that was made earlier today. The requirements that you discussed are already made applicable to every person who wants to be an agent or broker in this state. And there's one other requirement which we would actually encourage you to also consider. In Section 1725.5 of the Insurance Code, there is an affirmative duty placed upon every agent or broker once licensed to immediately notify the Department of Insurance if there is any change in background information. So I know there was a discussion that there might be periodic rescreening or periodic rechecking of background, but I would encourage you to also impose that affirmative duty on any person who has been found. And to Dr. Ross's point about is it really worth the money, it's our view based on how we've seen the licensing laws change in California that the mere establishment of these barriers keeps bad guys out. And so I think it would be fundamentally a mistake to delay to some perhaps future date the full fingerprinting or other things. You should have that in place from day one. And I think you'll find that because you've done that, you'll keep bad guys out. And conversely, the failure to have those standards will only encourage more potential bad actors to come, you know, to the trough.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Lynn Kersey, Maternal and Child Health Access. I don't have prepared remarks, and there's a lot to remark on, but I want to focus just a little bit on the fingerprinting and background checks. Having been a from the beginning involved in Healthy Families and Medi-Cal, I don't understand where the concern is coming from that would lead us to fingerprinting assisters. You won't have that luxury with everyone who wants to help other people. They will not be fingerprinted. People going online themselves will not be fingerprinted. So I don't see it as a necessity. I don't know what led to this in the Healthy Families Medi-Cal history that would show that it's necessary or a deterrent. And I would disagree that there's even fingerprinting necessary, even if we went to background checks, because you can get anything you want, a federal, state, county level, through the background check. You don't need to fingerprint. That is, to me, it's an affront. And we do background checks at our own agency because we are first five recipient of funds, and it's a necessary component of that, those grants. But I don't see the need for fingerprinting at all. So if we do this, if we do have to put this through, let's look at whether or not agencies already do this and whether those certificates can be grandfathered in or used. But I think it will be a deterrent. And you can't make it evenly across every single person who wants to help and will help other people. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Hello, my name is Nenik Vu. I'm with the Hmong Health Collaborative, a coalition of seven organizations in the Central Valley serving refugee and immigrant populations. I'd like to talk about the costs borne by assister enrollment entities for background checks and fingerprinting. I know it seems that it's not that much to have $55 or $65 to be paid for these security measures, but for organizations that have operating budgets of less than $100,000, this is also a prohibitive measure because some of these organizations don't even have unrestricted funding. Some of it's only grant funding. And for organizations that do serve refugee, immigrant, or other vulnerable populations that require high needs, this might delay their process or even prohibit them from being able to participate. And so I would like to suggest that there might be a waiver of some sort for organizations that do have extenuating circumstances or particularly financial circumstances so that they can fully participate and we can get everyone who needs the assistance they need to get insurance. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Hi, I'm Dorina Wong, the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, and I want to support a lot of the comments that are around the concern about requiring background checks and fingerprinting and also the cost for the liability insurance that a lot of our Health Justice Network partners who are community-based agencies and smaller, they do have the cultural and linguistic capacity to provide assistance, but this would be a real burden on them to have to pay for this. And so we would recommend that Recovery California pay for it if they are going to require it. It seems like a lot of, as comments have said, that certified application assisters currently aren't required to have to go through all of these requirements, and we feel like, especially from a community-based agency, that they don't have the same motivations as maybe agents, insurance agents or other health plans may have, so that, you know, we feel like if you are going to require that, the community-based agencies have background checks and fingerprints, we would recommend that there might be a waiver process similar to what the Hmong Health Collaborative representative suggested, that if there's a reason why they can't afford to pay for the background checks, that there could be a waiver of those costs. Because a lot of the staff at these organizations, their prime role is not necessarily to enroll people, but it actually is to help the community, their community clients. And so we feel like we should encourage as many staff at these community-based agencies to be able to be assisters. Thank you.
Thanks, Tarina.
Hi, Carrie Sanders with the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network. In the interest of time, I'll just echo the comments that others have made on fingerprinting. I wanted to focus on a couple issues. Really excited about the town hall format. I think less focus on the board business and more on stakeholder engagement will really help to open access to groups that want to participate and have never, you know, spoken with the exchange before. Also wanted to congratulate the exchange on the launch of the website and the availability of materials in the Medi-Cal managed care threshold languages. Very exciting.
We've been tweeting about it. I hope others have too, but it's really nice to see that out there. Appreciate the NORC data on the SHOP focus groups, and just curious as to whether those were, I didn't see in the slides whether it was just in English or other languages. We're always interested to know. And we appreciate, you know, the research that has been done so far. And then finally, with the CalHERS update, just curious about the timeline for future federal reviews of our IT system, particularly given, you know, we'd be interested to know what issues the feds might be flagging given differences in our in state and federal rules with regards to eligibility and enrollment. Thanks.
Thanks, Carrie. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Kathy Senderling for the County Welfare Directors Association. We were excited to see the new website. I think you're getting a lot of positive comments. Did want to just make one suggestion, and we'll share with your staff a link to our online portal so that applications can be submitted today online for Medi-Cal in its current form, as well as CalFresh and CalWORKS. Today on the website where it mentions Medi-Cal, it suggests that the County Social Services Office be called. Certainly that's a pathway, but given that the person is already on the web, we think you'd also want to direct them to the online sites that already exist. So we'll make that suggestion to staff as well and follow up with that website for them. Regarding the CalHERS update, I've commented here previously on the critical need for the interface between SAWS and CalHERS to be up and running on October 1st. Though it wasn't mentioned on this slide deck, we've seen on prior slide decks consideration of that being delayed until January 1st. So I did just want to reiterate that it's extremely important for it to be up on October 1st and ask that that interface not be delayed. And happy to provide further information if you'd like. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy.
Good afternoon, Melinda Bitney with Liberty Dental Plan. We will be applying as a standalone bidder in the process here. And I'd just like to see if I could get clarification. I understand because of the pediatric component being delayed now through or to be submitted by March 31st, just would like to confirm whether if the other components are submitted after the 1st, will there be a penalty or not?
We'll answer all the questions at the
end.
Okay,
great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Julie Broyles here on behalf of the California Association of Health Underwriters on the background check issue. As Mr. Young pointed out, there are currently requirements for those who are licensed to sell insurance to have the background and the ethical training. It is an all-hands-on-deck, and we certainly understand the need to get as many people there to help get people up and enrolled in Covered California, whether it's individual or SHOP. But we do think that in order to deter those who might not have the best of intentions, you need to have at least some standards of who you have helping people, because when money is involved, there are incentives to bad behavior. So whether or not you're an agent or an assister or any other piece that will be actively paid for helping people get enrolled, you do need to have some standards, and we appreciate the fact that the Covered California is putting that out there. Last of all, excited to see the website up and looking forward to directing a lot of people to your site.
Great. Thank you for your comments.
Madam Chair, members of the board, Mr. Lee, my name is John Glenn, and we represent the California Education Coalition for Healthcare Reform, or CHECR, which is an initiative of the Center for Collaborative Solutions here in Sacramento. CCS and CHECR already has trusted relationships with parents in about 3,000 after-school programs and virtually every labor and management organization in the schools, from the school board room to the schoolyard. CHECR and CCS has been riveted on improving the affordability of coverage and quality of care for the staff and faculty of the school system, such about 1.9 million lives, and as well as the student body and their families. That's about 12 million lives. The healthier the students are, the more they come to school. That's the business model there. CHECR is a statewide labor and management organization whose members represent about 1,100 school districts and community colleges in California. As I said, it's about 1.9 million lives. About 8% of those are not covered through their employment with the school district. And we're very committed to making sure that all of the school families, students, and staff and faculty are covered. Working with the School Employers Association at SEAC and the California School Employees Association, CSEA, and PTAs across the state, we look very much look forward to working with the California covered, and we've assembled a we're in a position to deploy a multicultural workforce that's already been fingerprinted to make certain that every employee and school member is employed, is enrolled. We're looking forward to that in 2013, and looking forward, while a surprising number of districts will be eligible for participation in SHOP, we're also looking forward to exploring large employer eligibility with the schools in 2017.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Janice Rocco, California Department of Insurance. My comments are having to do with the assister and with some of the covered California employee background check and fingerprinting issues. We are supportive of the staff recommendations about fingerprinting and the background checks. We think this is a critical consumer protection given the type of sensitive personal, financial, and even medical information that folks will have access to. We have been working with your staff and providing information about our experience and our infrastructure that we use in terms of playing a similar role with licensing of health agents. And given Commissioner Jones' experience with the oversight role he plays with the folks once they have been licensed, we think another critical thing that you'll want to look at is the oversight and monitoring that you'll want to do after the certification is done. So we'll be sharing additional comments with you before your March board meeting and look forward to answering any questions that you or your staff have. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Janice.
Hi, Elizabeth Landsberg with the Western Center on Law and Poverty, and just want to reiterate the comments of Ms. Saporta and Ms. Lynn Kersey and others on the fingerprinting and background check. I'm not sure the world is quite as simple as catching the bad guys. We think there, of course, needs to be a standard here to protect people's private information and appreciate the staff's concern, but are concerned about the fingerprinting moving forward. On CalHERS, we recognize that this is a Herculean task in front of us, but we are particularly concerned about delaying the Medi-Cal health plan choice functionality. If CalHERS is already building the exchange health plan choice functionality, we wonder if that could be leveraged for the Medi-Cal health plan choice functionality and wonder why that's so separate. We're also concerned about the authorized representative functionality as a basic thing that a lot of people are going to need to apply for coverage. We would concur on the importance of the interface between CalHERS and MEDS and making sure that's up before January 1st, and appreciated Dr. Ross's question about what's the biggest concern, and did note that it's really around the policy choices that we have to make and stand ready to work with the exchange, with legislative staff, and with the administration so we can make those policy choices and program them into CalHERS. Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the board. Mr. Lee, my name is Nala Kayali. I'm the founder and executive director of Access California Services. We serve primarily the Arab American and the Muslim community. And actually, I founded this organization to help enroll children in the healthy family in 1998. Regarding the background check and the fingerprints, we agree 100% to have background check. With fingerprints, it's going to be very difficult for the assisters, and mostly we work with immigrants and refugees, especially refugees. They come from refugee camps, and most of them, they have disease, skin disease, and they're not passing. We're an employment entity for the refugees in Orange County to employ refugees, and that's the difficulty we've been having for, especially with security, and whenever we send them to fingerprints, they're not passing because of the skin disease that they have. So please consider refugees and immigrants. And this is a entry-level jobs for them. And we've been having, we had in the past 14 years over 50 CAAs. And now they're looking forward to become a sister. So if it's going to be barrier, please consider the fingerprints. Background check, we agree 100%. And most of our grants, they ask us to do background checks, but the fingerprints, it's going to be a barrier for low-income people and refugees. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon. Mari Lopez, Visión y Compromiso. We, too, are concerned with the background checks and the requirement for fingerprints and support most of the comments, all of the comments that our colleagues have made, Western Center, Community Health Councils, Asian Pacific American Legal Center, among others. But one of the things I wanted to bring to the attention of this board is when this issue that about the fingerprint and the background checks, the type of message that you're sending to communities of color who would be concerned about such processes. And it's even for those who have no concern, it sends a certain message, particularly to immigrant communities. So I wish this board would take that into consideration. Also, with regards to the town hall meetings, we also support Green Lines comments regarding holding these particular events in an evening time when folks can participate fully and provide translation languages. Thank you. Services. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon. Betsy Umholtz from Consumers Union. Two quick comments, one on CalHERS. Consumers Union has been, I was going to say we'd be really been happy to look at all those details and comment on them. I'm not sure we're happy, but we know how very, very important it is. And so want to support whatever's going forward there and also appreciate the fact that there are policy decisions that have to be made to move it forward, whatever we can do to help in that process, whether it's in the legislative world or otherwise, to get the policy decisions made so that the technical decisions can get made and we can get this up and running, we stand ready to do. On usability testing, we're glad to hear that's going on and, again, offer our help in any way that we can participate in helping with usability testing. We've done a bunch of that in the past on our own. The second thing is about the website. Mazel tov, it looks great, and we've been happy to give comments on that. I really want to support and second Ms. Senderling's remark about putting something that will make it easier for folks to also get to Medi-Cal. If there's an online link, I didn't even know there was one, but that's great. So please do put that there and get people quickly and easily to Medi-Cal as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Betsy.
Madam Chair, board members, Chad Silva, Latino Coalition for Healthy California. We support the comments made by Carlos Saborda with greenlining. We would hope that there is a very close correlation between the purpose for which you are getting the fingerprints and the background checks and the harms you're trying to prevent, and I think it comes down to sort of the cost-benefit analysis. It would be burdensome for much of the folks that are going to be engaging in the process of enrolling people. We want to make sure, and I'm not sure there's any clear indication that these folks are should be culled out is a population needs this sort of level of background checks and fingerprinting. The background checks, I understand that you want to make sure the consumer is protected, but I would limit that to less burdensome means. Thank you.
Thank you, Chad.
Beth Capel for Health Access California to make comments on a few things other people have not taken note of. First of all, we were pleased to hear the report on the research that NORC has done, and we would suggest, and thankfully Larry Bai is no longer here to hear me make this suggestion, that having a monthly report on the ongoing opinion research that you're doing would benefit those of us who are trying to be helpful to you in outreach and education and understanding how the exchange is proceeding. And we gather from remarks of the executive director that there is a significant amount of opinion research going on that we have not yet had the benefit of learning about. Second, to echo the remarks of Western Center and others about the importance of having the Medi-Cal plan selection functionality live as early as possible preferably in October when the rest of the plan selection functionality is live. We understand this is not entirely a function of the exchange, but to the extent it is a CalHERS IT decision, we would encourage that that not be delayed, that people be able to sign up for Medi-Cal when they can sign up for CalHERS again. I bet there is not a single soul within the sound of my voice that knows what their modified adjusted gross income is. I certainly don't. So thank you.
Thanks, Beth. Thank you all for your comments. The next, Peter, you were going to answer some of the issues raised.
I'm largely not going to answer the comments. but
I
would.
One specific question.
Specific questions with regard to bid processes. We will do updates to those that have filed notice of intent to bid for both vision and dental on what this means. We sent out a note yesterday morning to those plans, letting them know about the decision to delay the implementation of supplemental benefits, and we'll do follow-ups to those plans. The other thing that I would note, I mean, I very much appreciate the comments, both questions raised by the board and others, and I would do a reminder note of a call-out I did in Los Angeles when I praised two particular commenters to us. And I'll name names again, because they're in our board packet, and I'd say look at them, and it's the comments made by Consumers Union and CPEN and Kaiser. They're in the board material, and the reason I'm calling them out is not because I agree with everything they said. Sorry, I agree with many of the things. But what they did in those comments was said, here's specific recommendations to you. Change this language, do it this way. And I appreciated much of the testimony went to those that direction. It's very helpful to us as we look at issues such as the issues of background and fingerprinting. A number of people testified, here are the sorts of offenses that you should exclude. Be specific. It really is very helpful to us, such as the issue of if we were to underwrite some assisters, which ones and how do we pick them? The net cost of $1.4 million is money we would otherwise potentially spend, as Dr. Ross noted, on grants to community organizations to paid outreach. So do we have any person that says, I want to be an assister, and we spend that $65, or are there criteria? The more specific you can be, help us be more specific as we come back to you. So we'd appreciate that. Finally, I'd like to very much appreciate the very specific comments that we got in terms of our website. And I'm now done, but I'll keep going. I would also, though, encourage you, as we improve our website, use the tools. Putting the material in the Medi-Cal threshold languages is because we think it's useful and it's going to be usable. Use it. If you find we've got some things we need to be improved on, tell us what we need to improve. Each of those fact sheets went through vetting with a number of stakeholders in different languages. We want to continue to improve. When you are on the website later this week, you'll see version dates on our fact sheets that aren't there today. They will be in the future, so you'll actually track our evolution as we say things better, clearer. We need your help to do that. With that, we're ready to turn to the next item on the agenda.
Yes, thank you. Service Centers, Julie Baker.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the board. This is a short presentation today, shorter than usual, although I will say at the January board meeting it was very short because I actually didn't get to present. So today what we're bringing to you is an update on the stakeholder input that we did receive from the January 31st webinar, where we did provide the full set of slides and updates that we had intended for the January board meeting, and also an update to two protocols in particular that we've been doing continuous development on with a number of stakeholders and our other business partners. So with that, just to reorient us on the principles that we surround ourselves with as we're working on the consumer experience here for the service center, just a reminder that these are the principles. They have not changed. They're the principles that we orient back to as we do this work. And I want to remind everybody that we do look back at these and we do incorporate them. In particular, some of the comments from the webinar had us highlight some of the culturally and linguistically appropriate communication channels that we continue to drive to, and providing clear, accurate, and responsive information tailored to consumers' needs. Very important, and all of these continue to be important. So on then the principles that relate to assessment and transferring of calls, those are particularly relevant for the updates that we have today on the warm transfer protocol. So I just wanted to bring these up to have people to refer back to. But a reminder on number five here that we continue to anchor in doing improvement of protocols based on metrics. So as we all have said before, the service center will be new, the protocols will be new, the business is new, and we will continuously improve based on the evidence that we receive through the metrics that we collect. Moving on then to the general operating parameters, you've seen these before as well, but reorienting us to these, and in particular number four, we continue to look at minimizing the bouncing of a customer back and forth. We want a customer to have a good consumer experience. We want them to not be bounced back and forth. We want them to get service as quickly as possible with as much accuracy as possible. So moving on then, thank you all for attending. Those of you who attended, we had over 287 participants at the January 31st webinar. We had many, many comments both at the webinar and also after the webinar. We have taken those comments in. We've read every single comment. And here we just provide a few of the highlights from those comments for you. I think that it was pretty clear both on the day of the webinar and in the subsequent comments that people are focusing really on making sure that the protocols that are developed include the same performance standards for all callers and for whatever channel they're coming in through, whether they're being warmly transferred to a county or coming into the service center. We want the same performance standards to apply. We also received quite a few comments from people who said, you know, let's make sure that we define some of these terms. So on that note, we have included some initial definitions, and we'll be adding more as we go through the development of protocols as that continues. But two in particular that we wanted to highlight are the definition of service level expectations and the definition of warm handoff. So as we're defining the service level expectations, and thank you again for those of you who commented with very proactive comments that we could pick up and modify to turn into these definitions. We are talking about the percentage of calls that are answered within a certain amount of time. We've been using the example of 30 seconds. That is the example that we want to adhere to. We do recognize, and I think we note on most of our protocols, that if that gets changed, we would look at changing that standard across the board, not just for the service center, but for the business partners to whom we're handing off calls as well. But this is certainly our out-of-the-gate intended experience for the consumer, 30 seconds. We also understand that there will be a dynamic processing throughout each week and month and day, for that matter, where we often put the 80% on this 30 seconds, and we say we expect to answer 80% of the calls in 30 seconds because there may be about 20% that, for whatever reason, during peak periods may take longer than 30 seconds. In any case, the standard here is that this standard will be developed in consultation throughout the coming months with counties, union representatives, service center workers, and our other stakeholders. The same service levels that apply to us at Covered California will apply to the counties when they're taking the calls that are transferred from Covered California. So that's what we're referring to when we talk about the service level expectations. Definition of warm handoff then, in the service center industry, what we mean by warm handoff is the transferring of a representative that stays on the line while they're talking to the customer service rep that they're transferring to. Just a reminder that this is the list of protocols that we have been tracking. We've reported on those previously as well as in the January 31st webinar. The two that we're looking at today are Protocol 1D and 1E, and there are some updates to these which those of you who have been following will probably notice. I want to mention, too, I think that the maybe an older version had gotten printed out for the handouts today. We do have this current version posted on the website, so make sure that you're referring to the correct version, which is posted on the website. But here we're covering the operational readiness prior to launch. This involves the functioning and tested phone system to the county consortia from the service center, staffing capacity to take the warm handoff calls at the counties, and then that staff training has been completed so that the counties are ready. We are in the process of developing a memo of understanding with the counties or consortia, as the case may be. What we envision there is a memo of understanding with each of the three consortia. And we will be including in those MOUs operational parameters that you see here. All of those terms are continuously under review by the administration, DHCS, the counties, and the unions representing service workers and other stakeholders. The readiness timeline that we are working on with the counties, you'll see here the various work streams. We have been in consultation to develop the readiness standards, certainly. CWDA and the consortia have been working on staffing plans and resource acquisition. We have a technical stream that we're working on to put in place those technical routes into the consortia from the service center. We're working on interagency agreements, as I just mentioned, and then training would occur once the staff are identified and brought on board. The final protocol that we have to present here today is the update on Protocol 1E, the warm handoff protocol. And here I want to just point out the updates have to do with talking about how this protocol needs to be reactive dynamically, as we'll be continuously measuring the rate at which the calls are handled and answered as they come into the service center and as they're answered by the consortia. And we need to use those dynamic metrics to be able to be agile with our responses. We have the warm handoff response here, and we also have other responses that may occur, depending on how the handle time is working with the warm transfers. These protocols would be continuously reviewed in conjunction, again, with the administration and counties. With that, I'll stop for questions.
Great. Thanks, Julie. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to do a time check here, and I'm going to lose a quorum at 4:30. So if we would try to certainly answer any questions that relate to Julie's presentation, we do have a couple of other issues that we do not want to put over from today's meeting. So, Kim.
Thank you.
Before, Kim, if I could?
Please.
That's okay. Just very briefly, I wanted to note one, again, thanks to our staff and others who have been working with us on, wanted to update the board that we've shared these protocols writ large. This is the whole full set that Julie went through with CSIO and CMCS, our colleagues federally, to make sure that this is what they would see as a permissible delegation. And we're in active, ongoing discussions with them, and they've looked at these, and in particular looked at the issues that Julie went through today with regard to the interagency agreements necessary for warm handoffs to counties, and find that this is largely an appropriate, what they use the term, permissible delegation. Because, again, I want to remind people that this process is an obligation of Covered California to do, that we can delegate if delegated appropriately. The one area that they want to have continued discussion about is this last slide that's on here, which is, again, we've been evolving these, looking at this, and we look forward to having more discussion with them next week. The issue of assuring that regardless of the individual, that they get the same treatment depending on whatever they happen to end up being enrolled in is important, as is for them and for us, that people don't get ping-ponged. So the fact that wherever people get sorted to, they get handled to completion is critical, and that's a critical element of both any and all of the protocols and what we've laid out here. But I wanted to, again, we're in continued discussion with MO1 of the board and our colleagues to know that in general.
Thanks, Peter. Kim.
So maybe and I want to acknowledge so much work has gone on and a lot of really good progress is being made at the state level with our state partners as well as our county partners. And I guess the one question or observation I make, maybe building upon what I'm hearing Peter say in terms of this last protocol, is are you developing an additional protocol that will enable us to assess whether or not the warm handoff is in fact working, and if not, what the kind of contingency plan is. So it's that piece that I'm hopeful is still under development and that we'll be hearing more about at our next meeting, because obviously if someone's called in, they've got a warm body, they've got an opportunity, and I have every confidence and expectation that our county partners will be able to meet the performance standards that are being developed, et cetera. But in those hopefully rare circumstances when that warm handoff cannot occur, what will happen? What is the contingency plan? Will the state service center worker, for example, be able to, you know, complete the assessment and then transfer the data to the county? But is that work still to be done?
And that is still what is called out here under performance review. So we see that really, Kim, as part of this protocol, but with sort of the what happens if kind of legs to it. So, for instance, if at the bottom of the performance review, if one consortium or county isn't meeting the standards, we will have backup plans for what happens with that. For instance, one consortium doesn't pick it up in time, should it kick over to another consortium so that there would be a Medi-Cal worker that would be able to pick up that call? Or should the assessment be done by the service center? And those are the things that are still in discussion, but we do hope to bring to conclusion.
Okay, so backup plan, contingency plan. Again, the hope and expectation is that this is in a very small number of cases, but it will be important that we have some backup. So that's what we'll be hearing more about at our next meeting.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Bob.
Yeah, I want to thank you, Julie, and I do, Peter. I want to commend staff. This, we're seeing movement in real significant positive directions on defining these terms, on the protocol development, on defining warm handoff, and beginning to put some standards around and expectations. But I also want to thank. It's been a great witnessing of the stakeholder input and staff responsiveness, because this has just gotten better sort of week after week in terms of getting to where we needed to get. I'd like someone today, and I don't know whether that's you, Julie, or Peter, Kathy, I think Kathy Sunderling is still here, but I would love to hear as my colleague mentioned, Ms. Belshe, on the county readiness side of the equation, issues of staffing capacity and training, what level of confidence do we have that that's going to be there when the consumers need it? And so whoever is best positioned to address that question, and that may be a work in progress, but I certainly am all ears on that one.
Peter's ready for
you. If I would, Dr. Russell, I'd like to take that up at the next meeting, because I mean, we've laid out a timeline that the consortia, the counties, are really in process having meetings on that now. They know that having staffing plans is a core element that we need to have before we do any handoffs, but if it's okay, let's. And in some ways, I see this issue similar to CalHEARS. Issues having good service, we're updating it at each meeting. Let's, if you could, let us bring that back at the next meeting.
Thank you. Public comment. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
And if you would help us be mindful of our time and not defer to each other's comments if they are repetitive. Beth, lead us off, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Beth Abbott from Health Access. In the interest of time, we had some comments on the protocol and the definitions that we would like to meet with Julie to perhaps clarify or expand or further delineate. Sure. So we will make comments or meet with her at her convenience to adjust, if
Great.
Possible, those. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Beth. I appreciate that approach. Thank you so much.
Betsy Umholtz from Consumers Union. We've said it over and over again, the key importance of the service center. This is the first encounter that many people are going to have with Covered California, and how critical we believe it is that we get this as right as we can get it, knowing perfection is probably going to elude us all. So a couple things. Great progress on trying to get some definitions and acknowledging that the same service level standards will be used no matter what door you go in. You can expect whatever it is, a 30-second pickup of the phone or whatever. Questions that I have are, for one thing, the order. We're going to have agreements being entered into, interagency agreements. Understandably, we need those. But the order of the readiness assessment, and the service level standards, those being set, and then the agreements. It sounds like the agreements will be entered into, and then after that, perhaps some of the readiness information will come forward, or the performance service level expectations will be set. And I may just be reading the charts wrong because I just looked at them today. So I'd love to know more about that. Secondly, we've talked about memoranda of understanding, MOUs or agreements. I thought previously we were talking about contracts. So I'd love to hear whether I'm just missing something, or have we shifted now to MOUs, or will it be contracts? And the third thing, I guess, key point is the performance needs to be measured, I believe, strongly on an individual consumer basis. And if we're talking about overall aggregate monitoring, of course, that's important, too, for staffing at the service center and at the counties, and to see how we're doing overall. But for the individual consumer, they're coming in and they're going to want to know if they're in this 20% and they're not going to get a warm handoff, what's going to happen to them. So I know this is all kind of developing and up in the air, and there's contingency plans going on, but I hope we'll measure it on an individual consumer experience level. Thank you.
Thanks, Betsy.
Carrie Sanders with the California Pan-Ethnic Health Network. Just wanted to start off by appreciating the acknowledgement of staff to the needs of limited English proficient callers, and the clarification that standards will apply across the board for all callers, including hearing impaired and limited English proficient. We appreciate more the transparency around the performance measures and protocols. We would just appreciate greater information about how the stakeholder consultations are going to work. It mentions other stakeholders, and we're hoping that includes consumer stakeholders as part of that process, and that we'll be a part of those conversations moving forward, particularly with respect to protocols like the warm handoff and also, you know, some of the other issues that haven't been addressed here. And
Thank you. Thanks, Carrie.
John Connolly with Insure the Uninsured Project, and I'm going to echo all of the points that Betsy Imholtz made. I think she made
them
all for me. We just applaud you that you standardized basically all of the standards that you're going to create for different service centers and for all of the different kind of callers that you'll accept. Second, we think that a unique ID for calls will be essential in interagency agreements. And then third, we also think that performance reviews and contingency plans at the next meeting will be essential to establish.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for your comments.
Hi, Kathleen Hamilton with the Children's Partnership. Really want to take a moment to acknowledge, as Dr. Ross has pointed out, the extraordinary opportunity to engage in constructive discussion and the ongoing development of these policies and protocols and anticipated processes with staff. We very much appreciated the opportunity to do that and see the growth and the maturation in these updates as they move along. So while we still have a few suggestions, we see progress and are very appreciative of that. A couple of things. In looking at the readiness timeline, it also strikes me that it might be a little bit out of kilter, so we're going to look forward to a chance to talk more with staff about how we can have an interagency agreement, an MOU entered into before a readiness consultation is completed. So it seems to us that might benefit from some additional work. On the contingency plan for how the service center would handle a situation where a warm handoff in a timely way isn't possible, understand that's going to be taken up maybe at a future discussion, but we do think it's very important that in that instance the service center retains that caller and is prepared from a resource and staffing perspective to complete that enrollment and application in the event the warm handoff doesn't take place. And I would also like to nominate consumer advocates to be included in the ongoing stakeholder process if you can call us out. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Tia Orr on behalf of the Service Employees International Union. I first off would just like to thank you and the staff for putting together such a, I think, well thought out process for us to, you know, just be excited around. Our eligibility workers as well as our state employees are very excited about the opportunities to come and are really eager to start getting to work on a lot of the difficult work that we have ahead of us. I think the roles and responsibilities that are spelled out were very helpful for us. And again, getting us geared up to work on the training and work on staffing ourselves up so that we're prepared for the new work. I would like to reiterate that we are committed, like you are, to providing a first-class customer service experience. All of our workers statewide, countywide, are committed to that goal. And again, we look forward to working with you as we move forward on the procedures, the protocols, the training, and a lot of the difficult conversations we might have on performance measures. But we're committed to it, excited about it, and thank you again for involving us.
Thank you, Tia.
Hi, Kathy Sunderland, County Welfare Directors Association. The counties really are pleased to be at the point, we think, of really rolling up our sleeves and getting to work on the implementation of the structure that you're seeing. As Ms. Orr noted, we're very committed to the first-class customer service that you also are committed to. And we're really champing at the bit to get going. So I'm pleased that there is so much structure now decided. Yes, there are things to be worked out, important details still to be worked out, but it seems like we are at a point where we can really move forward. And to that end, Dr. Ross, I think you're asking really good questions about the readiness and planning. We'll certainly work with Peter Lee to bring back information to you, but do want to assure you that this is something that, from a technical perspective and a staffing perspective, we've been thinking about for over a year now. What might the technology needs be? What would the staffing needs be? And working with the exchange staff as well as the administration to look at the kinds of volumes that we're talking about to ensure that both at a statewide and at a county level we'll be able to achieve those readiness standards, get the resources that may be needed to add on to the service centers that most counties already have in place. Obviously, when you look at that timeline, a lot of things do have to fall into place in order for everyone who's got a piece of that timeline to be keeping to it. We will do our part. We are committed to that, and we look forward to this partnership so that we can be able to accept those calls on your behalf starting October 1st. Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. Thank you all. I appreciate your concise and helpful comments. The next agenda item is the Qualified Health Plan contracting, and Peter, if you would open that, please.
Great. We are running late in the day, and we're going to have two very quick presentations, then a more in-depth one on the bridge plan. The shortness of the presentations from Andrea Rosen on our plan contracting and Ken Wood on standard benefit designs does not do justice to the historic nature of what both of them are presenting on. And as many of you know, we presented the standard benefit designs a week or so ago, truly historic, and California is absolutely leading the way. And what you hear from Andrea in terms of the level of very active engagement of health plans to make sure we're successful is also historic. With that, they know that they're going to be presenting very quickly, and then followed by David to give an update for the action item on today's agenda, which is the potential bridge plan. Andrea?
Madam Chair and board members, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking with you about where we are in the evaluation selection process and the model contract, and start out by saying that we don't see those differently. We did receive many comments on the model contract, and we are deep in the process of reviewing them right now. But we just need to remind ourselves that we are talking about the same thing, the selection process for the plans that will hopefully partner with us in the model contract go together. Where we are currently right now is very deep in review of the first response that came in January 25th, and we're happy to report that many of the original 33 plans, which did respond to our notice of intent last October, are currently actively bidding. These bidders, who are confidential, as Peter noted earlier, currently serve the vast majority of the individual market in California. They cover the landscape in terms of statewide plans, regional plans, and Medi-Cal plans. We are thrilled that they do include some new market entrants and plans that have also expanded their current line of business and expanded into new service areas. So this is the type of competition that the Affordable Care Act anticipated, the exchange being able to stimulate. If the board and federal officials approve the bridge program, new Medi-Cal plans may be certified as qualified health plans in covered California. And lastly, just to emphasize that review and discussions with bidders are confidential. We have established processes for both the QHP solicitation and the standalone dental plan solicitation where bidders can submit questions to us and receive responses, and we're going to stick with that. I would like to say, though, that we are continuing the stand. Just to be clear, we are continuing the standalone dental plan solicitation process. We've made one revision, and that is that the premium bids are due now March 31st to sync up with the qualified health plan bidding. Let's take a moment to go quickly through the timeline. We've added several new line items to our timeline. As you will recall, the first response to the QHP and the second response have passed. Those were January 25th and February 25th for the submission of the Essential Community Provider Network. So we're actively reviewing all of those responses now. The next one comes up February 28th when the provider networks are due to the regulator so that they can begin their network adequacy review. Premium bids are due to us March 31st. We are intending to release the next model contract on April 1st, asking the public to give us comments back on that draft on April 14th. We did receive many requests to release the administrative manual, which we had been working on internally. And this is kind of the parallel document where a lot of the nitty-gritty, you know, what number electronic submission you have to do, is it an 834 or an 837, that type of stuff. And so we're intending to release that on April 15th with a goal of having a final model contract on April 25th, requesting public comment on the administrative manual by the 30th, sticking with our, we hope we can stick with, issuing our tentative QHP certifications and reaching agreement on the contracts by May 15th. So that the reasonableness rate review by the regulators can take place between May 15th and June, which will position us to enter into final contracts and issue final certifications of covered California plans on June 30th so they can be loaded into CalHERS on July 1. And I'm going to turn it over to Ken Wood at this point to discuss the standard benefit plan designs. And I will be available for any questions on the timeline or any other solicitation issues you have.
Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you, Andrea. And just to echo Peter's comments, I really applaud the board's courage and leadership in adopting standard benefits. I think this will be seen as a very key turning point. As Katie mentioned last week, when we did receive final regulations from the federal government on rating and something called the actuarial value calculator, I was delighted to see that it allowed us actually to improve the benefits that we had published the prior week, particularly for individuals who have some of the best cost-sharing plan and the lowest income. So it was overall very good news that we were able to lower office visit copays for primary care and specialty care in many plans, lower the costs for x-ray tests and lab costs. So it was a very positive move to have that occur. And I feel like we're at a place where we have a fairly important breakthrough in simplification of healthcare benefits for consumers. This chart, while it has numbers on it, I really want to point out the colors first. We have achieved a place where the benefits are the metallic designs you've heard, platinum, gold, silver, and bronze, the richest benefit being platinum. Anything you see in green is a cost where there is no deductible for a consumer to have to satisfy before they are paying, in general, a copayment. One of the very key feedbacks we had from consumers as we talked to various groups was they really didn't like the fact that deductibles and coinsurance made it hard to know what's my cost, what am I going to pay. So the green in this chart gives you a sense where the vast majority of the benefits, until you get to the more catastrophic designs on the right, are based on an upfront pre-identified cost. And so that's the critical piece. The second piece I'll call out is that regardless of which product you purchase, there is fundamental protection from bankruptcy being driven by an insured individual. The highest out-of-pocket maximum that we have in the most catastrophic benefit plan is $6,400 for an individual. Now, while that is a lot of money, compared to what is driving consumers into bankruptcy, You may have seen the Time magazine article this week about a family in the Midwest having $450,000 of expenses. That is a significant safety net for any and everyone who purchases coverage. So we're delighted to be able to do that, and there's a double that protection for a family. So if a family happened to be in some type of catastrophe, really limiting cost to a maximum of $12,800. I'd like to move quickly, though, to a very, very important slide and one that I'd encourage you to focus on after the meeting. Now that we know what the benefit designs are, for those 2.6 million Californians who are eligible for subsidized care for the tax credit, we already know what they're going to pay. We don't have to wait for the bidding because what they pay is a percentage of their income. We now know what the benefit designs are, and based on their level of income, they now can see what I pay out of pocket as premium up front, and they can see what benefit design they'll be able to buy. The only question left is, well, what health plan will provide my service? Who am I going to pick? The first slide, the first column, individuals making, this is a family of four, between $23,000 and $35,000 a year would pay a monthly premium of between $39 and $118. And the benefits they would be eligible for would be a $3 office visit copay, $5 specialty copay. You can just look down that list, emergency room copay, $25, all the way down, and you just really see a very, very generous benefit program. We have frankly not seen benefit programs like this in California in decades. So I'm really pleased that we have the ability to have, looks like I've activated something on the screen. We have the ability to bring extraordinarily rich benefits, low cost sharing, and I think what will be affordable premiums. The second column, the third column, and the fourth column are just moving up different bands of income. The very top column, a family of four earning up to $94,000 a year, you know, middle-class family, maximum premium cost would be $746 per month. You'll see, though, that the benefits are not as generous. The Affordable Care Act purposefully adjusted both the premium and the benefit level for those that receive subsidies. So this reflects the designs in the federal legislation. But I think it's very, very good news for the citizens of California. We've worked hard to be sure that we can protect those and be sure they have good coverage. There's always trade-offs. One of the most difficult trade-offs has been around individuals who have high-cost drugs. We've tried to look at how we can manage that as best as possible. Today there are drugs that do cost $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for a year. But people are protected by the annual out-of-pocket maximum, which allows them to be sure they will have no more cost than that in a given year. And they're not paying retail. We are doing this through benefit plans that have negotiated effective rates for all care. So with that, unless you have questions, we'll be ready to move on.
Peter, thank you,
Ken. Very briefly, one, I want to thank Ken very much, who's joined us and dove into the fast-running stream actively and incredibly productively, but also thank, and I'm going to call out a quote from one of the people that we quoted in our press release, actually Paul Markovich, who noted that as important as the result was the intensely collaborative process that produced it. Cover California's diligence in hearing all voices bodes well for our success in meeting the many tough challenges ahead. This benefit design was the product of months of work of consumer advocates, health plans, insurance agents, doctors, nurses, representative hospitals. And what we have and we have as a model for the nation is a benefit design that is about putting patients at the center of care, having design that encourages people to get the right care at the right time, not to be a barrier to care and not to be a shell game. I think the many people in this room and more broadly that participated in creating this should be rightfully proud of what California has done to lead the way for the nation to say benefit designs should be geared around care and the patient and helping patients get the right care. And I really want to appreciate Ken's leadership in helping sharpen this, but it rests on hundreds and hundreds of hours of time of a whole range of people.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter. Questions from the board. Susan, for Ken.
Ken, on slide 3, where you discuss the affordability improvements that were achieved, you have, like, for example, the 10 to 35% reduction office copay in both the subsidy and non-subsidy plans. Reduction from what?
We had announced publicly at the press release our standard benefits, but we did not know when the federal government was going to release the final regulations. They came faster than we expected. If we had known they were coming last Thursday, we would have held off. But we had no advance notice. So this just is the change between our press release 10 days ago and now the updated improved benefits.
If I could, that updated and improved benefit is what is going to all the plans, so they know those are the benefits upon which they are bidding between now and March 31st. So bring together what Andrea presented and Ken. Is that the full details of the benefit designs are posted today or last night posted on our website and sent out to all the plans that are bidding. So they now know that it is a $250 brand drug deductible at Silver. All those specific changes are baked into the
bundle. These specific plans are the required bids. So truly consumers for the first time will, it's like shopping for a car. I can go look for a Taurus at this Ford dealer and a Taurus at that Ford dealer and know they're the exact same vehicle with options. That's what this is allowing.
Thank you, Ken. I'd like to have us ask David to present on the bridge program so we have everything. Oh, Ken, oh, I'm sorry. Kim had a question of Ken.
Yeah, of course, Ken goes scurrying away.
My apologies.
No. I think one of the really important things about what we're doing here is that we are advancing a very different model relative to, I think, most other state-based exchanges. So our policymakers gave our board the authority to be an active purchaser with that ability to selectively contract. Second, the authority which we've exercised to standardize benefits. Peter, you used the terms I like, this is a really big deal, or this is a game changer. And I think both of these tools represent very important game changers to the extent they give us an opportunity to advance California-specific goals above and beyond the federal requirements, and secondly, to facilitate meaningful consumer choice to drive decision-making not on risk selection but on quality and affordability and cost. So just two observations in terms of the comments that I had a chance to look at that kind of registered some, I'm not sure if they're flags, just considerations. Mm-hmm. Number one is some concerns that we're not being sufficiently clear in terms of articulating what is required in the model contract of QHPs relative to federal and state law versus what we are requiring above and beyond that that reflect our goals around quality improvement, delivery system reform, et cetera. And secondly, or relatedly, being clear about the value added associated with those California covered California specific requirements. So it's in terms of operational requirements, quality improvement strategies, performance standards, et cetera. So again, just sharing an observation that I think is a really, to the extent there's some evidence to support that concern, to the extent we can be clear about what the baseline requirements are in terms of federal and state law, and then what we are requiring above that and the value added we think it brings in terms of advancing some of these broader goals around quality and affordability. And secondly, you know, we are very much committed to creating a consumer-friendly marketplace that can inform and empower, I mean, it's core to our mission, empower consumers to make meaningful choices based upon quality and affordability. Another concern I've heard is that a lot of the requirements we're offering are actually potentially adding complexity to the marketplace, and that had the potential to confuse rather than clarify meaningful consumer decision making. So I just wanted to share those two observations and my concerns relative to these game changing opportunities we have.
And if I may, I'm not going to let Ken respond, and we'll bring that to the next board meeting because we're going to have more rolling up our sleeves looking at the contract issues and those which I think are great ones to give us time for bridge, if that's acceptable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David.
Okay, the moment we've all been waiting for, the bridge. Lights, camera. First, what I'd like you to do is just to sort of frame this just to remind everyone why we're talking about the bridge. Three goals that we have: affordability, encouraging access to the local safety net providers, and encouraging Medi-Cal managed cares to Medi-Cal managed care plans to participate. Following last month's meeting, we've been working pretty hard on a number of things. We've been talking to the feds, to our federal partners, about how this can work. We have been talking to our state and our managed health care plan partners on their issues and their needs. We've been working internally with our own QHP and IT teams to work out some of the administrative issues, and of course we've been talking to stakeholders. And based on the information that we've been gathering, we wanted to outline for you today two recommendations. The first is on the narrow bridge, and that we would begin implementation in 2014. The recommendation is that we would request federal approval to contract with bridge plans to enroll transitioning Medi-Cal managed care enrollees and the parents of Medi-Cal and CHIP children. And that we would also, in order to facilitate, make it easier for Medi-Cal managed care plans to participate, we would streamline the QHP certification process. The second element of our recommendation is on the broad bridge, where we would conduct further discussions with the federal government and research, and that ultimately the concept that we would propose would build on the narrow bridge and would include those that are under 200% of the federal poverty level. Just to sort of remind folks on how the math on this works, we had asked our actuary Milliman to give us a sense of what kind of premium impact one could have if through a bridge mechanism. And we've seen these a couple times, but assuming that the second lowest premium came in for a silver plan at $400, if a bridge plan came in at $380, 5% below, that would result in a premium of about $34 for someone at 150% of poverty, or $94 a month for someone at 200%. We did the same kind of analysis for assuming a hypothetical premium of $500, just for frame of reference. So, in terms of what the narrow bridge is all about, and specifically what the recommendation would be, a couple of components to this. First, Covered California would offer the opportunity to Medi-Cal managed care plans that become qualified health plans, bridge plans, that would offer continuity of care and keep families together. Plans would have to meet our criteria and offer standard benefits, and they would have available to them a sequenced bidding process so that they could come in at the lowest cost silver for their enrollees, and then through that mechanism come in with that, provide that premium benefit that I outlined previously. In talking to our IT folks, it was clear that, Jim Brown mentioned earlier, that the launch date for this would have to be in April 2014. The good news for that is that it would give time for the participating Medi-Cal managed care plans to develop their applications so that that they could have a much more robust bid and program. There's a lot that they have to do, so this gives them the time to do that. In terms of eligibility, this would include individuals that are transitioning from Medi-Cal, as I mentioned, Medi-Cal or Medi-Cal CHIP, and household members in what's now Healthy Family. Our estimates from the UC Berkeley Labor Center are that there are between 670,000 and 840,000 Californians in 2014 who would be eligible for this. There are a couple other things I just wanted to mention. Consumer choice. Consumers would not be forced to accept a bridge plan if they didn't want to. They would have a choice of any of the qualified health plans that are offered in Covered California. It is likely that there would be income or duration limits that would be required by the federal government as we proceed with federal approval for this. And we would note that the Department of Managed Health Care, which would be responsible for determining network capacity, would base that capacity on bridge plans, on the bridge plan product solely. We also, at the prior meetings, have talked about what might be done to streamline the QHP solicitation process, and there are a number of things that we could do. First, to try to encourage Medi-Cal managed care plans to participate, and these would include responding to elements of the solicitation that are applicable to non-commercial health plans, that it would accept state Medi-Cal and quality performance requirements as satisfying the exchange or the Covered California requirements for 1 year, that for plans that are not certified by NCQA, that we would give them a little time to initiate that accreditation process with the intention of completing the process by 2016, and doing what we can to coordinate with our regulators to streamline licensure. But we go beyond that in the case of Medi-Cal managed care plans that want to become bridge plans. Specifically, we are talking about a revised certification timeline, and I sort of gave you a sense of that earlier. We would allow, Covered California would waive the requirement that bridge plans offer all of the precious metal tiers and catastrophic plans, with the exception of silver and gold, which are required by federal law. This is one that would require a state law change. We would support a policy to allow bridge plans to offer benefit contracts on an interim basis, not to exceed 2 years, while they're pursuing Department of Managed Health Care regulatory approval. And this would address the timeline requirements necessary for material modifications of their existing plan licenses. And finally, we'd allow Medi-Cal quality reporting features such as HEDIS measures to be used in lieu of other quality data requirements. In terms of the broad bridge, again, we want the opportunity to continue further discussions with the federal government and our research on what the market implications might be. We want to build on the concept of the narrow bridge to include the eligible population under 200%. We want to continue the discussions with the federal government on what our options might be, and we want to assess the market implications of the broad bridge. And the next steps are threefold. First, as I mentioned, there is a need for legislation. I'm very pleased that it's likely that Senator Hernandez, the chair of the Senate Health Committee, has introduced a spot bill at this point. It's SB 1X13, and the administration is sponsoring legislation. We're providing technical assistance at this stage, and it's our expectation that language which would go into that bill will be available soon, and it will be moving through the legislative process. Secondly, we would like approval to request federal approval so that we can move forward on the narrow bridge as quickly as possible. And, it's clear, I think, in our discussions that even the narrow bridge is not going to be a slam dunk. This is something, there are a lot of technical issues that are going to have to be resolved, and we're looking forward to working with our federal partners and to have an expression from California that this is something that's important to our state. Assuming that we have federal approval, we want to proceed with implementation as quickly as possible. There is a lot to be done, both in terms of our qualified health plan selection process, but also the build requirements for CalHEARS. So that's our bridge.
Yeah, I know I wanted to do a quick calendar timing note for the day. It is almost 4 o'clock. I know that we will lose one of our board members in about 4 minutes. We will lose a quorum at 4:30. I wanted to let folks know that the topic on eligibility enrollment we will not be getting to today, but have no worries. We will have many bites at that apple. So in early March, we will have a webinar on the material that's been presented. We will welcome board members to sit in on that. We will have a first draft of proposed eligibility enrollment rules at the next board meeting without final action until the meeting in April. So there's plenty of time to roll up your sleeves, engage in those. I appreciate very good work from staff and DHCS, but I want people to know that don't worry about that. We aren't doing it. And engage. With that, I turn it back to the board. We do need a consideration of an action at this time.
Thank you. Bob? And then we'll go to questions.
Yeah, I apologize. I'll be the one that needs to leave to catch a flight in about 10 minutes. But thank you, David and team, for the presentation. And I just wanted to let you know, Madam Chair, even if I'm not here when the vote is taken, I'm happy to make the motion in support of the staff recommendations. The recommendations, as outlined by David, have certainly my support. And I've also heard from and read some of the comments from stakeholders on this issue as well, so I've taken it into consideration. So.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob. Do we have a second? We have a motion and a second on the board resolution. I would open it now for questions and comments from the board, and then we'll take public comment. Do you have any questions or comments? Kim.
Thank you, David, and appreciate the continued good work to kind of further focus and inform what is a really important issue that addresses a concern I think we all share around continuity of coverage as well as affordability, particularly for those individuals whose incomes will bump them into the exchange eligible range. I'm very supportive of the recommendation as it relates to the narrow bridge, given the contribution I think it has the potential to make around continuity and affordability. And the fact that it is consistent with federal guidance, which allows us to move forward and put the key pieces in place so that this can actually add value to those individuals, as well as the contribution it makes to our safety net providers, who are critical players. So we want to be a part of the work we're doing together. I guess my question is more about kind of next steps around the broad bridge. And if you could just say a word or two about, you know, what work is being undertaken in terms of research and assessment of market implications. We talked last month about an array of issues both on the upside and potential concerns around the broader bridge. And so just trying to get a better picture of where staff is in the evaluation and research around those issues, particularly given the interest in continuing discussions with the feds. I still am struggling a little bit in terms of discussing what the it is that we're discussing with the feds, and do we have an understanding of the implications of it to inform our position?
Well, in terms of what the it is, at a conceptual level, I think we acknowledge that there is an equity issue that relates to people that are at the same income level but who may not have been in a Medi-Cal managed care plan. People who may be working at low-income jobs but have never been in Medi-Cal. The policy question is whether or not there is a way of allowing these folks that have the same income as someone that's participating in the narrow bridge to participate in a bridge plan and have the benefits of a bridge plan. Now, there are a number of legal questions about what is allowed under the Affordable Care Act and what kind of flexibility the federal government has. At this stage, I have to say that it's fairly uncertain about what we would be allowed to do. However, I think you can make a pretty strong policy case that a broad bridge makes sense, and I think that's something that we think is important to continue having that discussion with our federal partners, because I think that they, in terms of the success of their ability, our collective ability to implement the Affordable Care Act, both in California and nationally, is going to depend ultimately on our ability to enroll this very low income population. And to the extent that there are options that are out there that allow us to maximize that, I think that's in the benefit of everyone, both providers and the federal government and the folks that are responsible for the Affordable Care Act. So,
again, I'm supportive
she's
of the recommendation
honing in, I can
to,
feel
to
it.
Move forward on the narrow bridge, but I think your comments just underscore for me, David, the value of if there really is going to be a serious effort to advance a broader bridge. I think the board would really benefit from a fuller discussion about the implications of that approach, not only for the equity consideration that you articulated, which is a real one, but also for the broader Covered California implications associated with an approach that effectively would direct all individuals up to 200% of poverty to a narrower set of plans, the implications of that for the value of the tax credit, what that means for affordability for the market more broadly. So, I mean, there are a whole range of issues that I don't know if those are legitimate concerns or not, pending a fuller discussion. So I appreciate your point or your conclusion that a broad bridge makes sense. I frankly continue to not believe I have enough information to inform that. So if we're going to be aggressively engaging the feds, I will say again, I really would appreciate a broader conversation about the broader bridge and its implications, not just for that one group of people, but for the Covered California population broadly.
And just if I could note that the recommendation brief before the board is not to have an aggressive, fast action on the broad bridge. The federal early indications are that is very troubled in terms of getting federal approval. And given those uncertainties, the brief specifically notes that we have not conducted comprehensive analysis on the market impacts, consequences of the broad bridge's implementation, and don't have a very near-term work plan to do in the next 2 months. We have a lot to do to get the narrow bridge, which can affect hundreds of thousands of Californians, up. So we would certainly come back to the board before we ask board action on aggressive forward movement on the broad bridge. We're seeking action to begin implementation on the narrow bridge.
Thank you. I think that's the right focus and prioritization.
Thank you. And I would say, because I've said before and it's not new, that the administration is in support of the broad bridge and is advocating with the federal government in support of extending the bridge up to 200%, and we would like very much to have the partnership of the exchange in that effort with the federal government on support of the broad bridge. Thank you. Bob, I know you've got to scoot. Are there any other questions that you I want to show the proper respect before you have to leave, and then we'll take Susan if you have questions, then we'll open it for the public comment. Okay, great. Thank you. Susan, anything? Okay, great. We have a motion, but we have to take public comment before we go to – so he will not be able to be here for the vote. Thank you. Yes, Peter.
Just the thing that I do want to note again, we are in many places – being truly a pace car. This is another place where California is being a pace car. We are laying out a detailed plan to serve as a bridge between people in Medi-Cal to have that continuity of care and affordability. We think we have a workable plan that we can get up and running soon. We're excited to be doing this in partnership with both Medi-Cal plans as well as safety net providers. And again, we've had a very good partnership with the administration on this. And I actually think it's exciting that our board is considering to act before legislation has been moved. It really shows this board's interest and commitment in terms of this population, this issue.
Thank you. Okay, Beth, you can lead us off with a public comment. Thank you. You're either our leadoff hitter or our cleanup batter, but either way, we appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beth Capel on behalf of Health Access California. We join with what we suspect will be many of our colleagues in supporting the staff recommendation to proceed with the narrow bridge. We also would join with the administration in supporting a broader bridge. We recognize that there is more work to do in thinking through the implications. But as we look at this low-income population below 200% of poverty, which is about 40% of your projected enrollment, this is an important option. And I want to emphasize something that Mr. Panish said in his presentation, which is this is a choice. This is very much like healthy families, where people will have the choice of the more affordable option if they choose it. But if they have been enrolled in a commercial plan that will be reimbursed at a commercial level and wish to pay more because they're just between jobs for a few months or got divorced or something happened and they want to keep their doctor, they will have the choice to do that by paying somewhat more. And I do want to also very much commend this board and this staff for what they did on standard benefit designs. Health Access has spent many years trying to get this implemented, and to see it as an official document of the state of California is truly quite a remarkable moment. And we thank you, and we thank your staff for being so responsive to our concerns about consumer comprehensibility of these. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth.
Good afternoon, Lynn Kersey, Maternal and Child Health Access. And as our name implies, we're concerned about the implications for pregnant women. We very much support the Bridge Plan. We want to commend this body for implementing this in such a timely manner. And given the issues with the basic health plan, really, really do commend you. But we are concerned about the co-pays with pregnant women and all low-income people. Pregnant women in preventive care should not be subject to co-pays. Premiums are still there for pregnant women at the levels listed. It's of concern. The scope of benefits is different than for Medi-Cal. CPSP, breastfeeding, dental are not there in the bridge plans necessarily, and we think there's some ways that we can combine these payment mechanisms so that women don't have to make the choice of a bridge plan that doesn't have the scope of benefits that Medi-Cal does, and Medi-Cal under the 200% program that won't have full benefits, full scope benefits if they break a leg or what have you. So we appreciate the staff is going to meet with us next week, and we will get more into the weeds then. But again, thank you for the bridge plan. We support it, but we want to work out some of the ways of working with pregnant women who are eligible for benefits under 200% program for Medi-Cal. Thank you.
Thank you. And we are going to lose a quorum at 4:30, so we're going to have to go to a one-minute requirement on this. I regret that, but if you can please be brief. And it is the other two items about the standard benefits and the presentations that were made before. So I know it's a lot to do. Thank you very much for your cooperation. Thanks, Micah.
Great. Micah Weinberg, Bay Area Council. We've submitted principles that we think should guide the creation of a Medicaid bridge plan, and one of them was creating a level playing field. So we're glad to see a lot of the phase-ins make sense to have those in place, and we hope that they happen rapidly. I think a really important point, though, is the way that we use language to talk about these things. We're calling it a narrow bridge, but it's not particularly narrow, and it's not particularly two-way. So when you look at the estimates of the number of people that would be eligible and because of the subsidies likely to enroll in the bridge plan, we're talking about a population on par with the basic health plan. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't want to do it or that it isn't a good policy option, but I don't know that narrow is the right word to use here. Likewise, I don't know if bridge is the right word to use here. Bridge implies two-way traffic, but because of the resetting of the subsidies for those people who are eligible for a bridge plan, that means that a commercial reimbursement plan, if it's for them the third most plan, is unaffordable. So it's really going to funnel people into Medicaid managed care over time as their income moves, and it's going to be a large number of people, hence a big funnel.
Thanks, Micah.
Hi, Brett Johnson with the California Medical Association. Just had a question and a quick comment. First question, and I think it relates to one of the earlier comments, but in situations under this narrow bridge where one member of a coverage family may be eligible for Medi-Cal and the rest of the family wouldn't be, it's my understanding under the Internal Revenue Code that the second lowest silver plan for calculation of subsidies is tied to any member of a coverage family having access to that plan. So it seems to me that under the narrow bridge that a pregnant individual who's transitioning off of Medi-Cal, that would also reduce the subsidy for the rest of that family, even if they're in a current exchange plan. And then just a quick comment on administrative difficulty. Every time I see something like this bridge plan and we talk about coordinating with the federal government and there's legislation that's out there and federal stuff, I just have the image of like a little kid climbing to a high dive with his little orange floaties on. We just keep going higher and it's not clear that we can swim yet. But anyway.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your comments.
Hello, Madam Chair, members. Autumn Ogden with California Coverage and Health Initiatives. And CCHI supports the value that bridge options can provide to the Californians in terms of making coverage more affordable to low-income Californians. strengthening and supporting the safety net, reducing churn between programs, improving continuity of care, and allowing families and children the option of being in the same plans with potentially the same providers. CCHI supports the staff recommendation for the narrow bridge proposal and would support continuing to look into the, the broad bridge proposal.
Great. Thank you so much.
Hi, Justin Garrett with the March of Dimes. I just wanted to echo the comments from Maternal and Child Health Access. We also support the bridge plan, but we do share the concerns about copays for prenatal care and scope of benefits for pregnant women. And we've sent a letter outlining our concerns and look forward to discussing more with your staff.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Shannon Smith Crowley, representing the American Congress of OBGYNs, and he said everything I was going
Great.
To say.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Hi, Francie Morey from Anthem Blue Cross. On behalf of Anthem Blue Cross, we would like to thank the board and staff for seeking feedback on the draft bridge proposal. We are very committed to working to promote quality solutions that promote affordable and safety net continuity. We are concerned that pushing the bridge will take away the main core goal of the exchange. There are many outstanding technical issues that would need to be resolved, and to be ready for 2014 calendar year will be challenging. However, we do appreciate the board and staff's support and being very collaborative in developing a solution.
Great.
For this
Thank
population.
You. Thanks. Thank you for your comments.
Hi, Ruth Liu, Blue Shield of California. We'd also like to say we understand the need for a narrow bridge plan as a way to improve affordability and continuity of care for individuals coming off of Medi-Cal, but we do think that this is a broader bridge than maybe was intended with the narrow. We also want to emphasize that this should be a transitional program, not a long-term option for folks, and so we think the appropriate duration and income limits should be taken into consideration. In terms of the practical need for a streamlined process for certifying bridge plans that operate only in the non-commercial market, we understand that that is something that should be done in the short term, but we think it's important that the exchange endeavor as quickly as possible to extend the same level of protection and quality insurance to bridge plan enrollees as to all other exchange enrollees. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth.
Bill Worley, Kaiser Permanente. We just want to remind you, as you consider whether there's a broader bridge or two-way bridge, however that comes out, in particular if it's not feasible for 2014, that you do have the selective contracting authority, and by just paying attention to the difference between the lowest and second lowest cost silver plan, you can potentially, in each region, you can potentially achieve quite a lot of improvement in affordability. And so we just hope you won't forget about that. And we support the proposal that you've adopted so far. And lastly, we come up here to cajole and urge and plead often enough. We do want to thank your staff for their work on standardizing the benefits and congratulate you, as Beth said, as Peter said, as Vice President Biden said, about what kind of a deal it is to standardize benefits. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Hi, Edie Ernst with Private Essential Access Community Hospitals. PEACH supports Covered California's pursuit of a narrow bridge with that goal of greater affordability and access while supporting the safety net. However, we do continue to be concerned about two essential components that would ensure access, and of course that's affordability of premiums as well as adequate provider networks. While we appreciate that the latest board brief does include a little more information about how provider rates might be derived, we still have many questions in terms of that analysis and some of the assumptions therein, so we'll follow up with staff regarding that. Providing rates that are above Medi-Cal reimbursement obviously is a great step in the right direction, but since Medicare DRG rates are far below actual costs, we do still have concerns that safety net providers will not be able to take on more patients at a loss. As Covered California contemplates pursuing bridge plans, we urge you to establish guidelines to ensure that those provider payments cover reasonable costs.
Thanks, Evie.
Jeff Shelton on behalf of HealthNet. I'll be very brief. For the reasons that are stated, we think this is a good proposal, and we'd urge you to vote for it.
Thank you very much. Hi, John.
Hi. John Ramey with the Local Health Plans of California, all Medi-Cal managed care plans. mindful of Peter's admonition to be direct in saying what we want. We are very grateful to the exchange staff, Mr. Panish, to Senator Hernandez for his unrelenting commitment to affordability and to the governor for taking an interest in affordability in the exchange and making a specific proposal. Two things we want. One, we want affordability for health care to be as broadly applied as possible, and we admire the ingenuity that went into the development of the proposal that is before you. And we want it applied to as many Californians as is practical and possible. The second thing we want is that we want the safety net providers who provide the core of our provider network to be able to continue to provide those safety net services to the many uninsured that will still be amongst us as we go forward into an era of broader coverage in our society. And in order for them to be able to go forward, they're going to be able to need to keep the patient base that they have. Payment mix for their patients is critical to their success, and we want that payment mix to be to their advantage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John.
Good afternoon, Sarah Nichols, on behalf of the 800,000 service employees from the International Union in the state. And I would associate myself with Mr. Ramey's remarks and also just add that we support a bridge that's strong enough and broad enough to provide a real solution to our working families. And we really thank you for the work that you've done on this. To preserve affordability, continuity, and the safety net. This is a very modest first step, thanks.
Thanks very much, Sarah. I know it is so hard to be brief. You all are so helpful in this. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Athena Chapman with the California Association of Health Plans. And CAP and our member plans support the narrow bridge option. And as many people have noted, since we are 10 months from implementation, there are many details that may be clarified in the coming weeks. And as plans have a lot of expertise and information in this area, we have reached out to the exchange to offer to help work through some of those operational details. We are specifically interested in what exactly the streamlined QHP application process will look like and look forward to more information on that. CAP also provided Covered California with a comprehensive set of comments on the draft model contract, and we would look forward to continued discussions on all of the items in that as the next draft is released. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And I know I have a caller, but I'm going to finish here in the room, and then I'll come to the person on the phone. Thank you for your patience on the phone. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Muller with the California Association of Public Hospitals. First, really want to acknowledge staff's work on this and very much build on John Ramey's comments. We are supportive and want the bridge program very much to move forward. This really has a good opportunity to target a population that I would argue is most at risk of not enrolling in Covered California. Although they have significant federal subsidies attached to them, they are very low income and don't have much room in the family budget for premiums. So anything we can do to make things a little bit easier for them to participate, I think is well worth doing and certainly well worth exploring. As safety net providers that serve a large number of these individuals, we have some suggested recommendations to further strengthen this proposal and very much look forward to working with all of you to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Landsberg with the Western Center on Law and Poverty in strong support of the Bridge program. We like the name Super Bridge that David used to use, and we would love to see the Super Bridge, but understand you need to move forward with the narrower bridge. Appreciate the staff's work on this and the administration's commitment. On the standardization, also want to thank staff for listening to us, really moving away from coinsurances, which are hard for consumers to understand. It's exciting to see the standardization and exciting to see the vision of SB 900 and AB 1602 realized in the state of California. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Hi, I'm Megan McCammon with the California Primary Care Association, representing California's 900-plus community clinics and health centers. Really quick, just want to thank David and the staff for their work on the Bridge program. Thank you for removing the waiver of essential community provider requirements, as I think that's an important thing to include in the qualified health plan, even for the requirements, even for the Bridge plan. I want to just echo the comments of Sarah Mueller and John Ramey and others in that we support both the narrow and the movement to the broad Bridge plan. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Byron Gross, National Health Law Program. We, too, support the Bridge plan and urge you to adopt it. We, too, share concerns about the impact on pregnant women, both in terms of costs and the services available, and are looking forward to participating in discussions to try to find solutions with that for that problem. Finally, I just want to say, in terms of the application of income limits or durational limits, which I'm not clear that there are income limits now on the narrow bridge or how that's going to work. We just want to make sure there's public vetting of that and it's not just discussed in discussions between SOCIO and the exchange, but that there is stakeholder input and exploration of what those limits might be.
We're not only an evidence-based organization, we are a very transparent organization,
We know that, but I just want to bring that attention that that issue hasn't really been vetted out yet and needs to be discussed.
Thank you for your comments.
John Connolly, Insure the Uninsured Project. Very briefly, we think that the standardized benefit is a great development and it will enable you to provide the consumer with a better shopping experience and apples-to-apples comparison, and also allow for innovation on quality and cost, which is really, I think, what this board is going after. Second, we support the staff recommendations regarding the bridge as they're written. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments.
Betsy Amels from Consumers Union. A strong support for the bridge recommendation from the staff, and also just a strong public thank you to the board and to the staff on standardization. I think this is really a landmark move and will really benefit consumers, so thank you.
Thanks very much, Betsy. Peter.
I'm sorry, we did.
Do we still have one person on the phone? Thank you. Yes. Operator, if you'd open the line, please.
We're going to the line of Cheryl Jansen with Patient Services Manager. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Megan McKinnon, Lymphoma Society. Thank you for taking my call. Treating cancer involves accessing a complex and extensive set of healthcare services, including combination drug therapies, targeted and personal therapies, and supportive care therapies. Unless policymakers provide affordable access to comprehensive care, the promise of the Affordable Care Act will not become a reality for cancer patients or survivors. LLS was disappointed to see that the finalized standard plan benefit design expresses patient responsibility for quote-unquote specialty drugs in the form of coinsurance percentages ranging from 10 to 40%. Please understand that many cancer patients simply will not be able to access their medications under this plan. By contrast, we've seen New York limit most patients to a flat fixed copayment. In fact, under the New York standard plan, most prescription medications would be limited to $70 per prescription. And one last comment, it is unclear whether non-network and off-formulary products can be counted against the total out-of-pocket expenses for patients. The total out-of-pocket maximum in the Affordable Care Act provides some patient protection. However, in order for that to be an effective safeguard, all patient out-of-pocket expenses, including balance billing amounts for non-network providers and spending for non-covered drugs and services, should count against a patient's annual out-of-pocket cap. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your comments. Thank you all for your comments. Peter.
Yeah. Before the board votes finally, I'd want to underscore one other thing. This has been, we're moving quickly on many fronts. With regard to the bridge, even developing this proposal has been an act of partnership, and it will need to be an act of partnership to implement it. And in particular, I want to underscore the last couple pages of the brief, which the Department of Healthcare Services will need to change its contracts with the Medi-Cal plans in a number of ways, and the Department of Managed Healthcare will be a critical partner in terms of looking at network adequacy capacity requirements that will be required to pass federal muster. We have had and continue to have great relationships with both of those parts of the administration, but they will be integral to making this approach work.
Thank you, Peter. Are there any other comments or questions from the board? We have a motion. I would call the question. Balshay?
Aye.
Kennedy?
Aye.
The chair is aye. There you go. With our last item being deferred to the next meeting, the last action item we have is for adjournment. Hearing no objection, we are adjourned.